Coming up on Boston Public Radio, a dog suspected of having Ebola was euthanized in Spain. A man suffering from Ebola died in Texas, joining thousands more in Africa. We'll ask you why the death of a dog seemed to have caused more angst for many than the death of their fellow men. Then one of America's most celebrated doctors, Atul Gawande, has a new book, Being Mortal, about how docs who know how to keep people alive have to learn how to help them die. Then at noon, the governor joins us for his monthly visit.
The Globe's Alex Beam will join us to whine about how book authors, like Alex, can't make any money. We continue our candidate interviews with Seth Moulton, who ousted an 18-year Democratic incumbent to run for Congress, and Heather Gladstone with frightening numbers on disappearing wildlife. It's much worse than you think. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So Ken Feinberg, you know him, the man who has been the compensation king for so many national tragedies from 9/11, to the Boston Marathon bombing, to the General Motors recall. His job is to literally calculate the value of a life. It's a deliberate system. It's based on things like the person's earning power, dependents, age, all those kind of things. But none of his reasoning, number crunching, algorithms, and piles upon piles of paperwork make any sense as soon as an animal enters the scenario. Yesterday, as you probably know, two lives were claimed by Ebola. Thomas Eric Duncan, he's a Liberian man who was the first person diagnosed with Ebola, died in Dallas, first in the United States. Excalibur is the 12-year-old rescue dog who belonged to the Ebola-infected nurse in Spain. He was euthanized yesterday. We don't know if he actually contracted Ebola. Now, if you ask Feinberg whose life had more value, Duncan or Excalibur, obviously he'd say Thomas Duncan. And from the looks of it, he would be in the minority. Listen to this. The fate of Excalibur, the dog, sparked a frenzy. Almost 400,000 people signed an online petition to save his life. I think it was in roughly 2 days. By contrast, only 150,000 people signed a petition, over 2 months, by the way, urging the FDA to fast-track research on potential vaccine and treatment for Ebola. 50 protesters swarmed the nurse's house in Spain in a last-ditch effort to save Excalibur. Where were the protests on behalf of Thomas Duncan, who was sent home from a Dallas hospital only to return days later after his condition got worse? Our number is 877-301-8970. Talk about wagging the dog. Is Excalibur diverting attention from the mishandling or potential mishandling of Thomas Duncan's life? 877-301-8970. This is a frequent theme on this show, but it'll be very hard to convince me that there is not a significantly greater part of the population who is in utter angst over the euthanization of this dog than was about, forget Thomas Duncan, about the thousands of people in West Africa whose lives have ended. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me.
I know. And the protesters outside were screaming assassins as the government officials
in Spain,
they went in to euthanize the dog. I mean, there is something about, and this happens all the time, there's something about an animal in extremis, particularly a dog, that people go bananas over. We talked about it a year ago or so with that puppy dog, the pit bulls. Generally, people don't like pit bulls very much because they're an occasion, you know, putting their teeth into somebody's ankle and refusing to let go into the person.
Or worse.
Know. Yeah, exactly. But this pit bull puppy, I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of people. We talked about this. It's rally in Quincy, like 800 people.
And the dog was horribly abused. No
he
one's
was
belittling
horribly
what happened to the dog.
He was horribly abused. But, you know, I was thinking about this a lot this morning. I think part of it is the plan get out that they were going to go in and euthanize the dog. So you had the living dog, you're thinking about him, and you had these pleas from the husband of the nurse, the Spanish nurse, Teresa Romero Ramos, who is sick, and her husband is in quarantine, and the husband is pleading for the life of the dog and saying he's part of the, you know, the dog hasn't had a chance to defend himself. I don't know how the dog's going to defend himself, and not knowing whether or not the dog had Ebola. So you're just thinking about, this poor Excalibur has got 5 hours to live, 3 hours to live, whatever it is. People went, off the deep end a little bit about the dog. I feel terrible for the dog myself. At least the dog was 12. He probably wasn't going to live that much longer anyway. Our number is 877-301-8970.
If we stop 10 of our colleagues, we work in a really smart building. we stopped 10 of our colleagues right now and said, what's the name of the dog that was euthanized in Spain? How many of the 10 would know the name?
I would say 8 of the 10.
How many of the 10 would know the name of the nurse who owned the dog who has Ebola?
2 of the 10.
Maybe, if that. 877-301-8970. Do you share our worldview? And I have to say, it's a little troubling to me. And it is fine to say, if you believe this, that most people care about both. But thousands of people have died in West Africa. Thomas Eric Duncan died yesterday in Dallas. And I'm telling you, scour the headlines. Look at the news. And look at the comparative grief. And I am telling you, and I don't have the numbers on the petitions, I guess, are hard data. It's not even close. Here's a little sound, by the way. Let's play for you. Here's reaction to the euthanization of Excalibur. And that's, we told you about the dog. At the beginning of the clip, you'll hear Romero, the nurse's husband. Then you'll hear protests as well as someone on CNN who didn't want Excalibur killed. Here it is.
My name is Javier Limon, Teresa Romero's husband. I'm in hospital, and I call on society to help me save my dog, Excalibur.
I can't imagine anything worse. You have Ebola, and now authorities want to kill your dog. Why don't they just isolate Excalibur? That would be the easiest thing in the world to do with a dog.
Did you hear that anchor on CNN? I can't imagine anything worse. Well, I can imagine something worse. Here it is. Duncan's death had many people, Thomas Eric Duncan's death, had many people questioning whether enough was done to keep the man alive. Listen to this.
Thomas Eric Duncan, the Liberian national who was the first in the United States to be diagnosed with Ebola, died Wednesday morning.
Why couldn't Mr. Duncan have survived?
He didn't have insurance, and he's a poor black man. He had a very deep accent coming from West Africa, and I believe that they didn't believe that he deserved the care that everybody else should get.
So there was one treatment for the Americans at Emory, one treatment for the American in Nebraska, one treatment for Eric in Dallas.
By the way, the last two people you heard were Thomas Eric Duncan's nephew and Reverend Jesse Jackson. And by the way, if you look at social media, Jesse Jackson was excoriated for having had the nerve to intimate that there was a separate level of treatment because Thomas Eric Duncan was a black man. And while it is fine to disagree with that, again, people are angry at Jesse Jackson because he raised the issue about the death and treatment of Duncan, and the world is rising up yelling assassin to Spanish authorities who killed this dog. And
well,
maybe
think,
they shouldn't have,
I
by
think
the way.
The husband did not have a ridiculous point when he said, and the other people that talked about this, they could have isolated the dog because there's some question apparently about whether dogs can get Ebola and transmit Ebola.
By the way, I'm not arguing for or against euthanization. I'm saying the dog was euthanized. What was the response to that as compared to thousands of people, now including Duncan's death?
But they're human. It's the premeditated killing of the dog.
Fine, and it's sad. It's really sad.
That bothered people and the idea. And there's a thing about animals being innocent. They didn't ask for any of this. The plea from the husband.
Duncan didn't ask for any of this either.
He may lose his wife. Now he's going to lose his dog. I mean, it was just, no, Duncan didn't ask for any of this either. You're absolutely right. But there's always you heard the person talking about, and he was defending Duncan, saying he didn't have insurance. And that was a terrible reason. If indeed that had anything to do with his being sent home from the hospital, and I have no idea.
I think in Liberia he was talking about.
If it did or not. But the point is, people view human beings, unless they're very tiny children or very elderly, and sometimes even those, as having somehow brought on their fate. They don't view animals as having brought on their fate.
877-301-8970. Let's go start it. Don in Burlington. Don, you are next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
We're excellent. Thank you for the call.
This is such a hot topic. It blows my mind how people treat their dogs and how they put them on this pedestal. For example, Joan Rivers left a portion of her estate to her dog. Leona Helmsley left millions of dollars to her dog. I see on a daily basis that people are treating their dogs better than they treat their children or their family members or other people in general.
I'm so glad you said that rather than me, Don. Go ahead.
No, you're correct. You know, Don, I have three children, but I'm leaving my home. Should I predecease my dog?
to Harry the dog.
Because I don't want him to be disturbed by having to go to a new environment. You know, he might be out of his element. You do. I mean, listen, I think a lot of dog owners. Are you a dog owner?
No, I'm not.
Yeah, I'm not at all.
I think
people get carried away. I mean, a lot of us are carried away. I probably am carried away.
But, Don, the answer, well, I don't know if it's the answer is the right word. The something to what you're suggesting is balance. Pets are great. People love their pets. They should love their pets. But we have lost, in my estimation, a balance between caring for our fellow man and caring for our dogs. Don, thank you.
I think it's definitely more of a respect issue where people get so frustrated because they look at their children and they don't respect or understand what they're going through. So what they do is they substitute it with their pet.
Maybe
and
so.
And their pet does not give them the feedback or
exactly.
is always loyal to them. It's
That's
insane.
Right.
Right.
Pets
Thank
are
you,
always
Don,
happy
the,
to see you
call.
When you come home, as opposed to the children that are really bummed out in their teen years, especially when you come in the door. Oh, they start hiding the contraband. You know what I mean, Jim?
390,000 signatures on a petition to save the dog in 2 days. Well, 150,000 over 2 months to urge the FDA to deal
listen,
with this whole Ebola thing.
We had a motto in my former life when I worked at the Boston Herald. I'm not going to repeat it now because I
what
can't say
it
on the radio, but about the stories that the most play, and they are animal stories. You put a tragic animal story, people go absolutely bananas. You write about a million murders, really tragic, involving people that were totally wrong place, wrong time, sometimes even children. You just don't get the response. There's something almost visceral.
We're going to go to Providence, where Jane is on the phone. Jane, thank you for calling Boston Public Radio. We appreciate it.
Oh, sure. I'm just one of those people that's off the deep end. And yet, I have children, and yet, my dog is probably my favorite of my children.
You're an honest woman, Jane.
Here's what I would say. You know what? It doesn't make sense to me that you would euthanize an animal. And Marjorie, you said this, but I was already in the queue, you know?
Yeah,
sure.
Why wouldn't you just watch
exactly
what was going to happen?
Exactly.
Clearly, if the dog had any symptoms whatsoever, they'd say, and the dog had Ebola, so we killed it.
And by the way, Jane, most experts in the field are saying what you're saying, going one step further, which says it's possible we could have learned some things about the ability or lack of ability of animals to transmit.
Well,
certain primates transmit it, but dogs transmit it.
But that's sort of a ridiculous argument.
Why not?
Because you could. I mean, people
isolate it and study it.
No, because people do experiments on animals all the time, and you could just get five animals. I'm not an advocate of this. It makes me cringe, but you could get five dogs and inject them with Ebola.
But if you have one that is there, then isolate it.
But I'm with you, Jane. Why not just quarantine it? The people with I suppose it would become ridiculous. People with the suits going in to give the dog his little bowl of Alpo at night. You
but
know
it
I mean?
Might be scientifically valuable. So, Jane, despite the fact that you believe that they should have quarantined the dog, let's go back to the beginning of your. How many kids do you have?
I have two.
Well, you have three, counting the dog. Of your
That's
three
right.
kids, your dog is your favorite.
Oh, I can't say. One of my children might be listening.
Yeah,
well, you already
right.
said it. It's too late, Jane.
We won't.
Here's the other thing.
Yeah.
Here's the other thing that, you know, it's not an issue, although it sounded that way from what you said to me. It's not an issue of, you know, people, so many people were upset about the dog. Why were so many people not upset about Duncan? I mean, I think everybody is upset about Duncan, and I think there's constant 24-hour coverage, and I'm not saying there shouldn't be, about Duncan. This is something in addition that people are upset about, and dogs are helpless.
Well, Jane, your assumption, if I may challenge it, is that the vast majority of people care about both things. If that were the case, in my opinion, we wouldn't be having this conversation. I know it's anecdotal. Marjorie wrote at her former life at the Boston Herald about 700 people at a rally for Puppy Doe. Where was that, in Quincy?
Quincy, on a Saturday night.
Not long after that, there was a rally in, what was his name, Jeremiah Oliver,
Maybe
the little boy?
Sunday night.
What was the name of the little kid?
I think you got to correct, Jeremiah Oliver.
And there were a couple of dozen people about a little boy who was abused and dead. And again, anecdotal, but I think it speaks volumes. Jane, thank you so much for the call.
But don't forget, the 400,000 signatures were to try to prevent the dog from being killed.
I could argue the other side of this in a court, too.
Over his neck.
Do you agree with my basic premise or not?
That the people care more about animals
yes.
than dogs? I think people express their outrage more over animals than dogs. I don't think people care more about animals than dogs. I really don't.
Do you think it would have
Jane
been,
did, except
would it
for
have
Jane.
Been of some value if 400,000 people, the same 400,000 people who signed the petition to save Excalibur's life, had signed a petition in 2 days to urge the FDA to fast track a vaccine for Ebola? Do you think I would think it would have mattered? Maybe a million people. I think that might have mattered. People do respond to public pressure. At least it would have made a statement about what we care about. Let's go to Marty. You're also in Providence. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Marty.
Hi. How are you guys?
Excellent. Thank you.
Good. So, Jim, I want to take issue with your assertion that people care more about animals.
Sure.
Than
please
people.
Do. Please.
Because I think that it's more this. When we talk about people, we understand people are complex. People have natural faults. We accept the notion of war and violence among people as just a fact of our life. People tend to have more visceral responses about animals because we see them more as helpless creatures.
I agree.
That we are their caretakers. It's, you know, they're beholden to us, and it's our responsibility to care for them. So I think there is the difference. It's not that we don't care. It's that there are just some things that we have accepted as a matter of fact and that perhaps inwardly outrageous, but outwardly we're so desensitized and so accustomed to, we just don't express that same outrage.
But Marty, before you go away, I totally agree with your thesis there, but it doesn't apply as neatly to this situation as it applies to others we've discussed in the past, because the vast majority of the people in West Africa who died and Thomas Duncan were as helpless in these situations as Excalibur was. And I just my assessment is, if they're in a similar situation, human or animal or non-human animal, our angst, our empathy is directed at the dog. But Marty, thanks for the call.
We're getting several emails in favor of the dog. And one of them is from Bobby, who says he's not up in arms about this. But he says, I think the issue here with the dog is that we do not know if it even had Ebola, and there was no need to kill a creature just because it may have had this disease. And I think that's where the outrage comes
right.
from.
Yeah.
And I think that is a big part of it. I think if the dog had Ebola, no one would have said, save the dog. But the fact that there's no...
You don't think people would have said, let's try to treat the dog, just like we're treating human, attempting to treat and save human beings?
Well, I hope not. I don't think you would say you have to go in your suit from head to toe and risk your life to treat a dog.
I think
you would mainly have the vet come in, and you mainly do what vets do to a lot of our dogs, which is give them the shot, and the poor dog is off to dog heaven, we all hope. Anyway, we're going to stay with this.
877-301-8970. I'm sorry, Marguerite.
That's okay. We're talking about the Excalibur versus the people who have been felled by Ebola. Why in the media kingdom dog always beats man? 877-301-8970. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. By the way, in about 36 minutes, the governor will join us to take your questions and ours. If you're just tuning in, though, for now, we're asking why, at least in the media kingdom, dog appears to more often than not beat man. Yesterday, as you know, two lives were undone by Ebola, or at least the Ebola crisis. Thomas Duncan, 42-year-old Liberian, died from Ebola, and a 12-year-old rescue dog named Excalibur was euthanized in Spain. And most of the public outcry, at least in, I think, both of our assessment in the last 24 hours, has been about the dog. And the outcry that there's been about what happened to Duncan, at least in my estimation, has been attacking Jesse Jackson for having had the temerity to suggest that, as he said, that there's different treatment for whites who have contracted Ebola than a black man, in this case, Duncan. 877-301-8970.
Tim in the car. Thanks for calling, Tim.
Hi, you guys. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Hey, I'm just trying to call you guys out because I think it was your Monday show that you played Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys had a few chuckles over the fact that nobody in the United States had been affected by Ebola, so why are we up in arms?
No, we did not. That's not what happened. We were talking.
Why don't you take
I'll be happy to say what we said, that we were suggesting that the media was doing what the media often does, is creating fear and panic where sane dissemination of public information might be a suitable alternative. We were not saying that the situation didn't matter or that we shouldn't be talking about it.
Well, so in this case, you're saying that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert were right in the approach that they took, and that you guys correct in the approach you're taking today? And are you creating fear and panic in your own way?
How are we creating fear and panic by saying we're spending too much time talking about a euthanized dog as opposed to 3,000-plus people and counting who lost their lives to this disease? What fear and panic are we creating?
Well, I think that's the argument you could have taken the other day, Jim. You're right. 3,000 people, just because they weren't American, didn't mean it didn't matter.
Exactly.
Well, that wasn't the approach that you guys were supporting the other day with Colbert and with Jon Stewart.
Tim, what we were trying to do, and it didn't work for you, obviously, is show the hysterical Stewart and Colbert put together a montage of these hysterical reports on television, implying that we were all, have to live in fear and loathing that Ebola was marching down Main Street and about to, run rampant through America. I mean, that's was what they were making fun of, and I think that's still legit.
And you guys had your chuckles as well, didn't you?
Well, yes, as a matter of fact, we thought they were both quite funny.
Yeah, we did.
Have played them.
We did.
Tim, thank you, though. We appreciate your call. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Ashburn AM, where Susan's on the phone. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
We're good. Thank you.
So I don't think this is so hard to understand, actually. I think that the whole dog thing is because people can, there's so many people who are dog owners. They can personalize this. They feel it in their gut, and the dog is going to be done in, and that is, their dog's a part of their family, whereas it's harder to personalize people on another continent in a situation that have an experience, even though, of course, that should be our area of concern. Also, I think that people give Mr. Duncan some agency. People have agency. He didn't necessarily come completely clean with the people who were taking care of him as far as his Ebola exposure. I think people were able to say, well, maybe that was partly his fault, even though it's a tragedy, of course, that he died. And whereas the dog, of course, has no agency. The dog is just a dog, and people project all of the innocence and the wonderful. Yeah, so
I think you've hit it.
Well, by the way, there's some dispute as to what Duncan said and didn't say when he was at first at the hospital. But I think that's a fairly decent analysis
well,
too.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't he involved in the care and moving of a person that had expired?
In Liberia, yeah.
That had died.
Yeah.
I'm not sure he confessed that to
the nurse. I'm not sure either.
When he came in. So I think Susan hits the nail on the head.
But Susan, the notion, even if that's a decent explanation, and Marjorie and I both agree, then what does that say about us? Because he, quote, didn't come clean, to use your expression, then
because
you know what it's about? The
he
word,
has
you know what the word is? The word
to,
is the same word that's used in the Middle East crisis, proportionality. I guess that's what I'm suggesting.
Yeah.
I'm not quarreling with anything you said, but I would argue there is no proportionality when it comes to the last 24 hours in discussion of this virus and its consequences. That's where I am. Susan, thanks.
But, again, I get back to the point that this was because they were trying to prevent the dog from
I understand
being killed.
That.
If someone were planning on euthanizing a human being, it wouldn't be just 400,000 signatures. People would go absolutely bananas.
Was there
about
more?
That.
Let's get back to what I asked you before. Was there more public outrage about Puppy Doe, or was his name Oliver? Jeremiah Oliver? What was Oliver's first
Jeremiah,
name?
Jeremiah.
Which was the more public outrage about, would you say?
There was more public outrage about Puppy Doe.
Well, fine. Well, there's not a situation of somebody being euthanized. Little baby who was abused, mm-hmm. little kid who was abused and killed, and a dog that was abused and had to ultimately be put to sleep. In that case, everybody would agree it should happen because the dog was obviously unfixable. There's too much history here of people transferring their affections and concerns in a disproportional, is that the proper
right.
English?
But again,
disproportional way towards
a lot of the protests about Puppy Doe was to make sure that the person that was caught for abusing a Puppy Doe was going to get in big trouble for abusing Puppy Doe.
Did you go to the arraignment, by the way? NECN had a report. No, NECN had cameras at the arraignment of the guy, I can't remember his name, who was accused of the Puppy Doe thing. There were not people there. It was packed.
Right.
They also had pictures of the courtroom at the arraignments of Jeremiah Oliver's guardians.
You would let me finish my thought. My thought was that they are raging against this one person and this incident.
Right.
In the Jeremiah Oliver case, your rage is against an agency.
How about the two people who did it, or the one person who did it?
You looked at the mother who was clearly not of right mind, and the father who was. I mean, you're going to rage against them.
Yeah,
you're
going to
rage against this mentally ill mother.
How about the father? How about the man who apparently is responsible for this?
I would argue they weren't the total fault here. I mean, not that I'm letting them off the hook. But you have an agency, a government agency, that is supposed to make sure that children are not abused by people that take care of them. And the government agency was the ultimate, I would say, fault because they can't do their job.
So did they protest? Those same people protest outside One Ashburton Place, DCF?
Well, again, I think it's different to protest a government agency than it is to protest a single individual or, in this case, an action that was planned into the future. I mean, that's part of the difference, too.
Okay, I hear you. Let's try Elizabeth in Somerville. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for the call. Hi.
Hi. I think in some ways we're talking about it in slightly the wrong way, because with the dog, I think what is happening is that people feel like that's something they can control. There isn't that much they can really do for people in Liberia. There isn't so much they can do for the man in Texas who needed care. But the dog, they feel like that's something they can actually have control over, and that gives them the energy to protest.
Well, but you know, I guess, and I have no science background, I am with Jesse Jackson on his concern, is why were there doses of this drug available for a couple of people before Duncan, and there was not a dose of the same drug, they had to do another one, a drug that worked, available for him? I mean, that's an area where I think people can demand answers, and at least in my estimation, not enough are. But Elizabeth, your analysis, too, I think is decent. I think everybody's is. All I'm just saying is there is not proportionality in terms of reaction, even though what everything you say, Marjorie, is true, and what most of the callers have said is true as
well. Here's another email. Gabriel from Brighton says, the issue here is about the unethical, willful taking of a life out of fear. So there you go.
By the way, again, there are a lot of people think that there were ethical problems with what happened in Dallas, Texas, too. But there's no uproar about that. In any case, you're not enough. Thank you so much. This is always is a very calming topic for us on Boston Public Radio.
You know what I think you should do, Jim?
Yeah.
I think you should get a dog, and then you'd feel good.
I like that. You know, by the way, I usually get email after this saying I'm a dog hater. I love dogs. Your dog is one of the cutest things I've ever seen.
He really is. And, you know, I think it would be a debate about who would be more missed in my family. Yeah. Coming up are advances. And that means me of the dog, not the dog of the children.
Thank you.
Don't want to cast aspersions on my three wonderful kids. Anyway, coming up are advances in medicine extending our lives or prolonging our deaths. Dr. Atul Gawande's latest book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, looks at how modern medicine often undermines what's best for the dying patient. He joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And advances in medicine have done wonders to keep us alive longer, but the medical community hasn't figured out how to keep us from dying longer. In his new book, and it is terrific, Dr. Atul Gawande calls for the medical community to change the way it approaches death. He writes, quote, I learned about a lot of things in medical school, but mortality wasn't one of them. The way we saw it and the way our professors saw it, the purpose of medical schooling was to teach how to save lives, not to tend to their demise. Dr. Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's, professor at Harvard Medical School, also a staff writer at The New Yorker. His latest book, the one we're talking about, is called Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Dr. Gawande, it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Well, you talk a lot in your writing and in your book about what you've seen in your own life, your own experience. But let's start in your introduction. You talk about a man you call him. This is a pseudonym, Joseph Lazaroff. Tell us about his situation and how you handled that.
Well, it was one of the first people I wrote about when I started writing. So this was as a resident. I saw this man who came in, and my job was to get permission on the permission forms for him to go to surgery. And he had come in. He was becoming paralyzed from a tumor that had involved his spinal cord, and it was a metastatic prostate cancer throughout his body. And he wanted that chance to beat this, is the way he put it. And so the neurosurgeon came in and said, well, let's do this. But this was a guy, he was emaciated. He was, it was clear it was his last weeks. And what he was hoping he would get out of this was not what we were going to deliver. So my job was to get his permission. And as soon as I talked about the risks and benefits, he said, there's a risk that I could die. There's a risk I could come out worse from this. What are you talking about? And are you trying to deny me my chance? I said, I'm sorry, and handed it over to him, and he signed away. He went into surgery, and he never made it out. He spent the next 2 weeks on ventilators, just worse and worse and worse, until we finally, with his son, had to take him often. He never got to say his goodbyes, never a terrible last couple of weeks. And he saw his wife die just this way, saying, this is not the way I want to go. What struck me at the time was, I said, I thought he made the wrong decision. Looking back on it 10, 15 years later, what struck me was we had not helped him make a good decision, that we were never honest with him all along the way, that we had not been talking to him about what he was actually facing until that crisis moment when he was beside his mind with anxiety and fear.
And why are doctors so why do they perform so poorly at this? No training, because it's so hard, because it's not a billable hour. Why is there this colossal absence of, yes, we know how to keep them living longer. We don't know how to work with them so that they die the way that and do the things they want to do.
Well, one of the reasons I zero in on is how the relationship between the doctor and patient has changed over the last 50 years. 50 years ago, it used to be, you know, doctor knows best, and we just tell you what to do. We'd barely tell you about the options. We might not even tell you what's really going on with you because we didn't want to worry your pretty little head. We, as patients, rebelled against that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and the way I was trained was to be doctor informative. Here is option A and option B and option C, and here's the pros and the cons and the risks and the benefits. And so, you know, when I would talk through something like that, I'd say, well, you know, there's a whole lot of risks here, but, you know, maybe there's some chance that you could survive and get a little bit more time, and the other alternative is you give up and you don't have any time at all. So which one do you want? And what I was not understanding is this core thing I found in researching this book. You know, what I did is I talked to more than 200 patients and family members about their experiences with aging and with serious illness, and also
some of your own family members.
Some of my own family members, yeah. My father, my grandfather. And then also talked to about scores of geriatricians, palliative care specialists, hospice nurses, nursing home attendants about what they saw. And out of it, I saw a picture of some of them who were able to have much more successful conversations and plans and understanding of what happened. And I had two fundamental lessons that came out of that, among others. One was that people turn out to have priorities besides just living longer. Surprise, surprise, but they do. They may be that I want to be cognitively intact, or they may be that I want to be home as much as possible instead of in the hospital, or I just want to have time to hang out with my dog. But the second thing is that the most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is to ask. And we ask less than one-third of the time what people's priorities are. And we never asked Joseph Lazaroff what his priorities were, and were we helping him achieve them?
But why? Again, that gets back to the question I was asking before. It's sort of like we've never had the discussion about race in this country because it's too hard. Mm-hmm. Is it too hard to have a conversation with someone about dying?
Yeah. So first of all, I described the fear that that doctors and clinicians of all kinds have that you might be offending somebody. I think also when you've handled these discussions in a way that really made people upset or angry. I think sometimes, you know, seeing somebody cry in your office feels like a failure. I think we conceive of ourselves as you know, that death is a kind of failure. It's hard for us to feel it is normal. Add to it that having these conversations take time. And,
that's,
you know,
a big point.
I get paid to do the operation.
Yeah.
I get paid very little to take the time to have these conversations, let alone multiple times. And the result is some of the lowest paid people in our profession, geriatricians, palliative care doctors, primary care physicians.
Contrast the story of Lazaroff with the story of the piano teacher.
Yes. So this is the story of my daughter's piano teacher. We live out here in Newton. My daughter was 13. Her piano teacher had, we thought, beat a cancer.
Young woman, relatively.
Yeah. She was in, around 60 years old when she was diagnosed with a cancer in her pelvis that had become so bad she had to undergo radical surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, and then seemed to be clear of the disease for almost 3 years, but developed a side effect of her chemotherapy, a cause of leukemia that she was undergoing treatment for. She kept teaching through that. And then suddenly for 2 weeks she canceled lessons. Turned out she was in the hospital. She called from there to with her husband to speak to me, and she was now really in trouble. Her cancer was back. Her leukemia wasn't responding to treatment. She had infections. She was in terrible pain. She'd been in pain for 2 weeks in bed, become incontinent. And she said, what do I do? And the question was, does she go for some kind of experimental therapy because the doctors had no standard options? Or does she go on hospice and, as she put it, give up? And I hadn't known how to have that conversation, but I tried the conversation that palliative care doctors had. And I asked her some basic questions. I said, you know, what is your understanding of your condition? And she said, I'm going to die. I'm going to die very soon. I said, well, what are your, okay, well, if time is short, what are your goals? And she said, I don't have any goals I can think of. So then I said, well, what are your fears and worries
for the future?
Is it hard
to ask that question? What are your fears?
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but
it is hard. But it's not nearly as hard as doing stuff like saying, well, here are the facts. You know, you got a 90% chance of death in the next 2 weeks. And, you're not offering a human side. And it's far easier just to say, well, what are your fears and your worries? It's saying, I'm on your side. And she said, my fears, I'm going to be in pain. I'm not going to be relieved of pain. I'm never going to get home. I'm never going to get to see family. I'm never going to have anything left. And what we recognized was, well, then let's fight for that. I think if she had been given the option of death with dignity, you know, assisted suicide.
Defeated on the ballot in Massachusetts,
yes.
Which could get Marjorie started, but go ahead.
Well, I think that many people in her situation would have taken that option. Mm-hmm. But what we said was, well, what if you fought for not longer time, but just having a good day? And what if we used our medical capabilities just to fight to have you have a good day? And she said, it's been so long since I had a good day. Let's do that. We signed up for hospice. She and her husband, you know, went home. A hospice nurse arrived and they said, what would a good day be for you? And at first it was just, you know, let's get rid of the pain. And so she got the pain medication. It took a lot. It took three different drugs. It got it under control. And then she lifted her sights and we got this amazing phone call. I told my daughter, you know, you're not going to have lessons anymore. Peg is dying. And she said, can I see her? And she said, I don't think so. I don't think it's likely. And then she called herself, Peg. Peg called and said, you know, I'd like to teach again. And we had Hunter ended up with 4 weeks of piano lessons every week. And then Peg had a recital of all the children who she had taught. They played for her. They played Brahms and Dvorak and Beethoven. And she wanted that chance to give that last something. Each of the children afterwards went up and she gave them a personal gift. For my daughter, it was a book of music she'd selected that she wanted her to learn. and then put her arm around her and said, you're special. And just wanted every child, she told that to every child, she wanted every child to know that. That's the legacy she wanted to have. And so she got a kind of passing that, you know, in our obtuseness in medicine, we don't provide. Those moments are incredibly important to people in their lives. It's some of the most important moments in people's lives.
Yeah, but we're talking to Dr. Atul Gawande, who's written this terrific new book. You obviously know the subject matter. If you've been listening, Being Mortal, Medicine, What Matters in the End. You mentioned this one-third statistic where it actually happens. The Institute of Medicine did something, Dying in America, whatever it was, recently. Yeah. They said what you said, obviously. 30% get it. And 90% want it. I don't buy that. Well, I understand that part of the problem is the doctor who's not ready, he or she, to do this or not equipped or not psychologically able, not trained. I tried to put my – after having read some of these stories in your book, including about your father, I say to myself, would I want to answer those kinds of questions? What are my fears? What do I want? Or do I want to live in blissful ignorance like so many patients do? Maybe you can fix me. And I'm not sure I would want to be asked those questions. And I'm not sure I would want to be honest. Am I wrong in that? Do you think patients want it more than I think they want it? You do, obviously. And what's the evidence of that?
No. Well, so there's a couple things. Number one, denial is normal.
That's what I was trying to say. Okay.
You know, I mean, there are people who all the way through do not and you can actually harm people. That's one thing that comes across from the evidence, is that, you know, trying to force down somebody's throat that, you know, you're going to die tomorrow. You know, that is not what you want to do. But, you know, it's really interesting. A palliative care expert or a hospice physician, they treat the conversation the same way I treat the operations that I do, as something that requires skill and practice and technique. And they've developed certain techniques. And one of them is that that when we have these conversations, it's not about me, you know. One of the things they said to me is, if I'm talking more than half of the time that we are in the appointment, I have failed. And then I paid attention in my appointments when I broke bad news, and I spoke more than 90% of the time. It's just a person nodding on the other end.
Trying to fill the air.
Air with facts and you know, emotional stuff, that, and yet not acknowledging what the other person is even thinking. And what they say is, just start with, what is your understanding of your condition? And people will tell you. They'll either say, you know, like they pegged it, you know, I'm going to die. Or I'm afraid I'm going to die. I don't know when, but this is going to happen. Or they might say, I'm going to beat this, you know, and I feel like I'm good. And
what do you do when you know that not to be true?
And, well, what you say is, you know, how much do you want to know about the statistics? What do you want to know? And if they say right now, I'm good with where I am, that's the other thing is, you don't need to solve it today. This is a process. And the fact that, you know, what happens, I call it the ODTAA syndrome, the one damn thing after another syndrome. When, you know, you get, you know, we all will reach a point where we're seriously ill or have troubles. And it's when it becomes one damn thing after another that you're on this train that you don't get off. And, you know, if it's not at one moment, it's the next moment that people start to say, okay, I am willing to talk about this. You know, we're all fighting for the best case scenario. Let's keep in mind what is the worst case scenario, and what can we do to know what your priorities are? I think there is no – people don't have trouble being willing to tell us what are the most important things that we work on.
Which the voice you hear is that of Atul Gawande. His latest book is Being Mortal Medicine and What Matters in the End. You just mentioned a couple of things I want to follow up on. First of all, death with dignity. That was a ballot question that lost big time. Some people call it assisted suicide. What do you think about that, people having the wherewithal to stockpile pills if they want to and to control their last moments?
I have a complicated view on this. Number one, I think that there are people who have unbearable suffering, and that it would be heartless not to be able to offer options mm-hmm. that allow people to have a prescription to give them some freedom from that. So I think in Oregon and Washington, it's been handled well. Less than 1% of people who die end up requesting and receiving the prescription. And what's really interesting is only half end up using it, because it's just the peace of mind knowing that it is there.
Which I think is a big deal.
Yeah, that if I reach that suffering, and this is the second part, is that fear indicates that our health system has failed people. Because what they fear is that there is no doctor and there is no nurse who is willing to make sure that I am not going to be suffering or have my priorities violated. And what we see, I think, is that it is far easier to assist with dying than it is to assist with living. And the goal is not a good death. I think that it troubles me when people say, you know, how do we assure people have a good death? The goal is to have as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And that's what, you know, a hospice nurse was able to provide PEG. I'll just point out that the Netherlands was the first country to have assisted suicide. And one of the things I think was a consequence, it was one of the last countries in Europe to actually have palliative care and hospice develop as a set of services for people. Because when you're suffering, it was far easier to just, you know, give people this way out. And in a country like, you know, I did a bunch of reporting from India for this, an investigation in India. And, you know, you see China, you see Korea. You know, you give assisted suicide, but you've built, you know, they literally give people no pain medication for severe problems. And, you know, people will choose that way out. If you say, I'm not going to give you pain medication, well, then, I'll kill me now.
Okay.
So, Dr. Atul Gawande, you've already changed the world. People know the checklist. It has changed the medical world. We know that. So what will the world be changed here with Dying in America out of the Institute of Medicine, your book, which I'm sure is going to be wildly well read? will medical schools and will the medical infrastructure say, we do have to train our people to do this? Maybe one of the ways to get them from here to there is with a checklist. I mean, what happens next if people buy your line of thinking, which I assume they will? What happens?
Well, so the biggest thing is that if we recognize people have priorities besides just, you know, survival and their safety, it moves all the way up to chain, up the chain. Half of the book ends up being about homes for the aged. And we're already seeing not only that we're going to have medical schools and have health systems that are willing to talk to people about what their priorities are as they near the end of life, but this is about what happens as the quality of your life diminishes even well before death.
Give some examples of the places that really get it right that you talk about in your book.
Well, here's this classic example. I visited a place here in Chelsea that has rebuilt the nursing home, still on the same amount of money, but they, instead of building the units around a nursing station where the whole goal is, you know, are you safe? They built it around a kitchen. And in the kitchen, the elderly people could go to the refrigerator and they could take food out of the refrigerator. Do you know how controversial that is?
Why?
Because if you go to the refrigerator and you're diabetic, you might take a soda. And that's not safe. It's not healthy. You know, the reason why, and then what do people say? When can I go home? Because in my home, I can go to the refrigerator and I can not only take out a soda, I can take out a beer.
Exactly.
Verboten. I mean, that's crazy, right? So an Alzheimer's patient can get written up. I mean, so by the way, this is a place where you can get written up, right, for violating rules. And an Alzheimer's patient, you know, can be assigned to have pureed food. And what do they get written up for? Hoarding cookies. Like, let them have the damn cookie. We can make places into homes. And what they showed in Chelsea is that you can make it a place, and this is called a construction called greenhouses that allow people to kind of grow and continue to learn and do things that are their own goals. And, you know, half of the patients there have dementia. That it can be a place where, because you allow people to take certain kinds of risks, they actually can be happier. They feel more purpose. They you know, you focus on how do they have connections to others, including, you know, others in the units.
So obvious because they're allowed to live. I mean,
well, you worry about the liability. That's what I think a lot of nursing homes are
afraid
about
the liability, and yet these people do not die sooner. On average, they die later. They have, you know, no more falls. But it is one of those kinds of things that requires us to change our frame. It is that people have priorities besides just safety and living longer. Here's another classic example. Up in Reading, Mass., I visited a place run by this amazing woman named Jackie Carson. It's a low-income housing project for seniors. And what she arranged is a woman named Ruth Barrett who has she has some dementia. She's missing like 30 years. But she makes choices every day about what she loves and what she wants to do. She's in a wheelchair. She needs lots of care. But what she loves is being with people. She loves going out. And so they arrange every Friday that she can go out with friends. And she loves to go to a TGI Friday. So they take her to a TGI Friday. And what does she like to order at the TGI Friday? A margarita. So they triple up, you know, the depends on her. They let her order the margarita. It is totally against the rules. And she is having a joyful, purposeful life. There are miseries, there are ups and downs. It is real life, you know, but it is not life in a prison.
So if there is change, Dr. Gawande, is it going to be because people realize this is the humane, kinder, and gentler way to treat our fellow men? Or is it because they read your statistics of, what is it, 25% of Medicare is spent on people, the 5% of their last year of life, where they say it's also economically good policy? What moves people more in your industry?
I think, in the end, it's going to be about what people demand before the medical industry demands it, right? And people are not going – I think this generation of baby boomers, as they enter into having needs, number one, they're going to want to be at home longer and want to have capacity more. But when they end up needing help, whether it's in at the end of life or in needing a place that will take care of them – people want to be in places where they have autonomy, where they have some control over what the story of their life is and how it unfolds. And so they will demand it and force it. I think that will lead to changes in the way we pay. You know, we're already seeing a shift coming out of healthcare reform and other areas that are pushing us away from just pay for quantity in healthcare. But it's very true that the almighty dollar does speak in healthcare, and it doesn't happen unless we also change the way physicians are paid so that they are enabled and rewarded to take the time to talk to people.
We have less than a minute left. Should a doctor start this conversation when you are close to dying, or can they start having this conversation with a patient when they're 40 or 50, or you know what I mean?
I think that knowing what your priorities are, it can start at any time, but it's clearly the moments when you start having some real struggles that aren't fixable. We're not very good at dealing with the problems we can't repair, and the way we become good at these issues you can't repair, that when we're up against it, then we start talking about, you know, what are your fears and what are your goals if these are problems that we are not going to be able to completely fix?
Atul Gawande, it was a pleasure. This is
absolutely
a great and important work. Congratulations,
it's a great book.
And
you
thanks
know,
for joining us.
No one wants to think about this. That's the other thing. But I've been thinking about it very much these last couple of days. Thank you very much. Dr. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor at Harvard Medical School. He's also a staff writer. He writes terrific stuff at The New Yorker. His latest book is Being Mortal Medicine and What Matters in the End. It'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight at 7 o'clock. The event is sold out, but you can also see him October 30th at the Good Shepherd Institute annual dinner at the Westin Hotel in Waltham. Up next, Governor Deval Patrick, thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Gawande.
Thank you.
Kicking off today's second hour of BPR, the governor joins us and you for his monthly visit. Politics in state and in D.C. and Olympics, medical marijuana, community colleges, and Ebola are just some of the things on our list. Call to tell him what's on yours.
Then the Boston Globe's Alex Beam will join us to whine about how book authors, like himself, can't make any money. We continue our candidate interviews with Seth Moulton, who ousted an 18-year Democratic incumbent to run for Congress. And Heather Gladstone joins us with frightening numbers on disappearing wildlife. It's much worse than most of us think. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Boston Public Radio. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
You almost didn't say anything, did you there?
I almost didn't. I was talking to the governor. I must admit. I got distracted.
Speaking
not
of
every
the governor,
day I get to talk to the governor.
He joins us in Studio 3, as he does every single month, for Ask the Governor. Good enough. Take our questions and yours. You can join him at 877-301-8970. Again, it's 877-301-8970. Or you can email a question to bpr@wgbh.org. Governor, how are you?
James.
Great to
Marjorie.
See you.
Lovely to see you both.
Thank you so much.
That was beautifully said.
It's his radio voice because he still doesn't know what he's doing come January.
Right. That's
correct?
Right. I'm auditioning.
That's right. That's right. So
I had a partner, and my law partner, who became a legendary federal judge here in Boston named Reg Lindsay.
Yeah.
And He grew up in Birmingham, Alabama. He was the first in his family to go to college, and he went to Morehouse. And one of the things that he did at Morehouse was a radio program. And his on-air name was the Midnight Mover Groover. So every once in a while, he would try on his radio voice. It was fantastic.
Actually, the governor's got a pretty good radio voice, doesn't he, Jim? Better watch out.
I am watching out, actually, Marjorie.
Room enough in the studio for three of us.
That's right. So not to go from something lovely and funny to something that's not so funny and serious, but you know, there's a lot of concern about Ebola.
Yeah.
We have a medical ethicist, Art Kaplan, who works at NYU, comes and talks to us every week. And he said for a couple of weeks that one of the things that really bothers him is that there's no sort of plan. I mean, people may be unduly worried about some spread across the United States, but there are people that are worried. Do we have a plan?
I assume what he was referring to. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the broadcast.
Well, just that there's no plan. We don't know what to do if you think you have symptoms, or if a friend, family member, or your neighbor, whatever.
So I'm glad you asked, because I brought my points from the DPH, because I thought that maybe you would ask. First of all, I think that there has been concern about whether. Is that better?
That's better, yep.
Okay, I'm having my microphone adjusted.
That's okay.
About whether there was a plan to contain at the source in West Africa. And I think you've heard over the last few days stepped up efforts by the international community to do just that. And that's a great thing. Here in Massachusetts, a couple things I want to say. First of all, there have been no reported cases of Ebola in Massachusetts, and by all accounts, from every source, the likelihood of the disease spreading here is very low. Nonetheless, we are well prepared, and I'll tell you some of the things we've been doing. The department's coordinated efforts since August with a network of providers, including hospitals, universities, ambulance services, emergency personnel, public safety, to go over plans for triage and reinforce the normal public health protocols already in place. It's hard to catch, and people should understand that. You have to come in contact with the bodily fluids of a person who is actually showing symptoms.
Right.
There's a whole checklist, a CDC checklist, that's been provided to all of the providers, all of the medical professionals on how to protect themselves and to protect others. You know, yesterday the CDC approved the state, our own public health, certified our own public health lab to perform the diagnostic testing for Ebola. So we have a resource right here to promptly check out samples for people who are suspected. Can't be spread easily. You can't get it from water or air, or it's not airborne. You really have to be exposed to the blood or other bodily fluids of an infected person. Couple things, I think. If may I go on?
Because
I think it'd be helpful for people to know a couple things they can do, and they're very common sense things. Personal hygiene, you know, washing your hands regularly with soap and water, or with one of those alcohol based. Hand sanitizers is a good idea. Obviously, you want to avoid contact with blood or bodily fluids of others as a general matter. Most important way to prevent the spread is to identify and isolate so-called symptomatic people. In other words, people who are showing the symptoms of Ebola, and they are a fever of 101.5 degrees or higher, vomiting, nausea, diarrhea, severe headache, unexplained bruising or bleeding. And in any of those cases, if you are experiencing that, or you see someone experience, or you know of someone experiencing that, make sure they get medical attention.
So you call 911?
Right.
I mean, what?
Yeah, okay. That's what you do.
You call 911.
That's what you do.
All right.
The way this spreads, it's not exactly like HIV/AIDS, but it's like HIV/AIDS. Remember when we were first all of us learning about HIV/AIDS, there was a tremendous anxiety that you could catch this deadly virus through casual encounter, because there was so little understanding of it. And I think that's some of what we've been dealing right now with Ebola. The transmission is similar.
You know, Governor, before we get to the, I almost called you Judge, but I have no idea if that'll be appropriate at some point in the future. Governor,
there you go, starting
before
something.
Before we get to calls, which we will in a minute, 877-301-8970, we had a discussion we're not going to get you involved in earlier in the show with listeners about the empathy and rage around the euthanization of this dog, of this nurse in Spain, versus the death of Thomas Duncan in Dallas. There's been a lot of controversy about the Duncan thing. Jesse Jackson has been there with the family and at the hospital virtually nonstop yesterday. He says there was one treatment for the Americans at Emory, one treatment for the American in Nebraska, one treatment for Eric in Dallas. And the hate directed at him on social media for having had the temerity to suggest, even indirectly, that race may have played a factor here is just, it's staggering. What was your reaction to the whole treatment of this Duncan man in Dallas?
Well, I think, you know, I know what I think I know from the news reports I've read, so I won't pretend to know the whole situation. I'm so sorry for him and for his family, and my condolences go out to them, and I'm so sorry for the sort of hysteria that Ebola has created in hysteria, maybe so the alarm that Ebola has created in the United States, where the risk of infection is so low. But I do think it has that alarm has prompted public health authorities all across the country and the CDC at the national level to step up their vigilance and their public education about it, which is important. I think directly to your question, I think whenever the issue of race and the you know the real or perceived influence of race is introduced into the conversation in this country in these days, it's met with all kinds of vitriol and the way sometimes. Folks react when they are defensively when they're called out on something where there might be a grain of truth. I don't know whether race played here, but it's with us in this country, and it doesn't. But you know, to me, the central question here is how we are all safe, how we are all responsible in the medical. In medicine to assure and in public health to assure that the public is safe and how we are all sensitive to the fundamental humanity of each of the people who are suffering.
That's the voice of Governor Deval Patrick. He's here till 1 o'clock. We're going to get to your calls about 1 minute. One other thing just to mention briefly, I was apoplectic, as I hope others were. I hope you were, about the pathetic turnout in the primary, 16-17% statewide. Mm-hmm. I know there were some reforms in election laws that you championed that actually passed the legislature. If you didn't have to worry about a legislature and you were the czar of elections, no, I'm serious, because I know you care a lot about voting rights and participation. If you could do one thing, change one thing, let's start in this state, to, in your estimation, to make participation fuller and higher, what is the one thing that you don't
thing?
Have? Well, two things, whatever you want. What would you do?
How about three, Jim? Why
whatever it is.
Generous?
So I would make it possible to register and to vote online. I think I'm right that Washington State has started down this path, among others. That, you know, sometimes in the past you used to hear things, Jim, about having a voting holiday or requiring voting, for example. I think if you make it, I'm not quite ready to require voting, although I think it is a civic duty. It's a duty of citizenship, but making it as convenient as possible, as we have tried to do here in the Commonwealth, and interestingly, as some states. Have tried to move in the opposite direction in order to influence political outcomes. I think calling that out and doing what we have been doing here and then some is good. I think the other thing is we got to figure out some way to get the influence of money out of politics, because it's a, you know, it funds so much destruction and cruelty in the races rather than the business of talking about what you're for and getting your positive message out. So I think that's part of what turns people off from wanting to participate or thinking that that they can have an influence. And I'll just offer one example, and I know Marjorie's trying to get your attention or mine. In the bottle bill ballot initiative, remember we've proposed the bottle bill expansion to water and sports drinks and some water bottles and sports drinks for, I think, every budget I've filed. And we get a lot of pushback from the industry I used to work in. And I remember after filing
it. You worked for Pepsi, for those
who. I worked for Coca-Cola. Watch yourself.
For those who don't recall. It's all the same to me, but go ahead.
It's not the same.
I remember I got a call from a colleague of mine in the industry, and I'll just leave it at that. Not at the company I worked in, but in the industry. And he said, when I filed it the first or second time, he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, you know, I know the arguments on the other side from when I was when I was in the industry, but I've done some homework. I understand it better, and I think actually it's good for us and good for the environment, good for the economy, for that matter." And he laughed and he said, "Well, you're going to lose." I said, "Why?" I said, "Actually, you know, it's popular here." He said, "You're going to lose because we have more money than you do."
And by the way,
that's
exactly
what's happened
what's
this
happened.
Time. I think the polls have totally flipped. People were in favor. But before we leave the subject, because you have run twice for governor, won twice for governor, Jim thinks that, I think it is heart of hearts, thinks that we should mandate, we should require people to vote, we should make people vote. My feeling is that I'd like to have more people vote, but if people are not engaged, don't know anything about the candidates, or going in there blind, as many people may do in some races, especially they may know about the governor's race, they don't know who's running for, you know, state senate, or you're better off not voting than voting for people or just voting straight party line. Do you think we should make people vote?
Well, you know, I understand that, and I know what happens in terms of voter participation in the democracies that do require voting, and it makes it feel it makes me feel embarrassed about the level of voter participation. But you know, I think it's worth remembering we get the government we deserve. Right, so if you sit it out, you'll get what we deserve. We'll get the folks who have who are always in, who always run, the activists who never miss a cycle. God bless them, and the same old debate recycled between the parties or among the candidates and the interest groups. If we want a different kind of government, if we want more responsive, more engaged government, more responsible government, then we have to go out and work for candidates who are about that and show up and vote. And we have to step up and run. That's the other thing. I mean, I have tremendous respect for people who make elective politics a career. It ain't easy, and they sacrifice a lot. But you know, the dynamic here in Massachusetts in particular, and we've talked about this before, as I experience anyway, is not a Democrat-Republican dynamic. It's more an insider-outsider dynamic. And it's hard to break into the political establishment here.
Can you imagine a circumstance in which you could be convinced to support mandatory voting?
Yeah.
Good. Let's leave it at that. 877-301-8970. The governor's going to take your calls. 877-301-8970. Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Stephen is calling. Is it from Windham, Connecticut?
Apparently,
yeah,
he is.
Yes, I'm sitting in my driveway. I love Jim and Marjorie, and I just happen to be there.
Thank you, Steve.
It's first dibs for Massachusetts residents, though, when I'm on the show, Stephen.
Go ahead, Stephen.
Well, thank you, because Southern New England, you're kind of our regional capital here in New England. Anyways, Eric Holder is retiring, the Attorney General of the United States.
What?
I saw your name. Yeah. I saw your name.
I got to go.
my thoughts on Eric Holder is I didn't like what he did with the press, but I think he's been outstanding on civil rights. Mm-hmm. And I think you would be a great pick. And if not you, who?
So glad he asked it instead of us.
That's
Stephen,
right.
Thank
yeah,
you very much for your call.
Cross
Stephen,
that off
thank
the list.
Usually that comes at the end of the show.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
When we're out of time. And so I think maybe I'll save my answer for the end of the show when we're
no,
out
but
of time.
In all seriousness,
no,
we debate.
So,
go ahead.
So on a serious note, I think Eric Holder has been a very, very fine and indeed in some respects exceptional attorney general at a particularly trying time in American politics and political leadership. And I think it has been enormously important to the president to have a true ally who was willing to stick with the administration as long as he has. I remember when I was sworn in. They had a ceremony when I was sworn in for Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights and at the Department of Justice. And I was sitting there and turned over the program as it was getting going, and they had all of the previous Attorney General's name, Assistant Attorney General's names listed with their tenure. And the average tenure was about 18 months.
Mm. Wow.
It is very unusual in modern history for an attorney general to hang in as long as this attorney general has hung in. And I think it's been enormously helpful. I agree with Stephen that in some respects I have been the proudest of General Holder when he has given voice to some of the issues around civil and human rights.
He was great in Ferguson recently.
He's been very eloquent.
So, wait. Okay, Stephen, thank you for the question.
Oh, and the question, am I going? No, I'm not going.
But you ruled yourself out right away, and I have to say, I really, in all seriousness, didn't understand. You have great respect for the president.
I do.
I know you're a very patriotic person.
I am.
I guess two quick things. One, why would you rule yourself out? I mean, I know you want to go into the private sector. You could wait 2 years. And two, well, have there been was there any outreach from anybody connected to the president to you about that job?
Well, so I said what I said as emphatically as I did because it's the same thing I've been saying and thinking and for 8 years since you, Jim, and everybody else have been asking me when
it's a different time. You're almost done your tenure.
Yeah, but I'm not done.
I understood.
And I'm gonna finish. And the promise I made to my wife and my family was that when I was that I would serve two terms if the people would have me, and that at the end of two terms I'd go back into the private sector.
Were there any feelers? Any feelers from the White House?
The president and his staff and I have talked about this kind of thing over the years. You know that we've talked about that in the past. And I'm very supportive of the president and the administration, as you know. And I have said before, I think I can help just as well, maybe better in some respects from the position I have.
When you say you've had discussions about these sort of things, meaning you've been consulted about appointments, is that what you mean?
You always ask me to be detailed, as you should, about my conversations with the president, and I always tell you I don't.
So were there any overtures? You still didn't.
He's asking me again.
No, but I'm not asking content. Was there any overture at all to you? And if there was an overture, I know you want to answer that, so I'll ask this and then I'll end with it. If the president, you wouldn't say no if Barack Obama called you today and said, I understand your concerns, I understand Diane's concerns, I need you for 2 years. You wouldn't say no, would you?
So I have, to some extent, frankly, I have been as emphatic as I have with the press here, so I don't get that call from the president.
If you did get that call.
We don't have to speculate. I'm not going to.
One last politics thing, and then we'll get back to the call. I was stunned to hear from John Walsh, who is the former chair of the Democratic State Committee and now the head of your Together PAC.
And the best grassroots strategist in America.
He's pretty incredible. Yeah. That when you leave office, I asked him this question on television. I asked him sort of as a joke, you're going to shut it down when Deval Patrick leaves the governorship. You're going to shut down the PAC. He said yes.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I'm going back into the private sector.
But the purpose wasn't to advance you, what you said. The purpose was to advance like-minded politicians around the country.
That's absolutely right, and I still believe that that's worthy. But one of the things I most hate to do is to raise money. Raise political money and ask people for it, and that's necessary to keep the PAC going. So that's not how I want to spend my time, and I'm going to make myself available if I'm going to be a has-been in a few months, but if a has-been can be useful to others who believe in governing for the long term, for the next generation, and bringing a set of convictions to their work and a willingness to pay the political price associated with that, then I hope I can be helpful.
Back to the calls, Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Cheryl is calling from Rockland. Cheryl, are you there?
Hi, Cheryl.
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hi.
Governor.
How are you?
I'm well, and yourself?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. Governor, I had a question. I heard you on the transmission of the Ebola virus.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you mention it cannot be transmitted through water. My question was, what happens to excretion, I mean, urine and feces when flushed into the sewage system?
Yeah.
Is it filtered out? Does the virus die? Is it
Is it that's a great question. I don't think I said it couldn't be transmitted through water. I think what I said is that it's transmitted through intimate intimate contact with bodily fluids. I don't know the answer to your question, but I'll get it before the show is over. I know that wastewater is treated before it's released, and there are filtration and or chemical treatments depending on the treatment plant. I don't know whether it's true in every treatment plant, whether they use both in every treatment plant. But I'll get the answer because I'll bet there are others who are interested in that. And I am, and I have the microphone now. So
stay tuned. We'll get you your answer, Cheryl. The governor will.
Thank you, Cheryl.
We have an email, Governor, from Vicki from Burlington, who's saying people have been waiting for a year to find out if they are eligible for subsidized health care. I myself, that's Vicki, has been waiting since January. Been told on phone the backlog is long, nothing I can do. They don't need more information, no further information on when a decision will be made. She wants to know when she can find out what the deal is and why the backlog is so long.
She can find out now. Nobody's been waiting a year to find out whether they are eligible. And I get if you give me Vicki's information, I will get somebody to follow up with her. Not everybody's been able to get that information on the website for the last year, and I'm really happy with the progress the team has made to make sure the website is fully functional in time for the next open enrollment this coming November. In fact, they are doing so well that it will be possible, we believe, for people to shop not just for the subsidized and unsubsidized products under the connector, but also for MassHealth through the same website. And that's a functionality that was supposed to be in place a year from now. So that's really, really good news. But in the meanwhile, people have filed paper applications. Those paper applications have been processed, and folks have been put into temporary coverage, if not a permanent plan. So I'll grab Vicki's information. We'll get back.
Governor, we have a ton of email actually about one subject, which is, and you mentioned progress a minute ago, which is medical marijuana. The ballot question passed almost 2 years ago, I guess 2 years ago next month. I had a guy on television the other night, Peter Hayashi, who's got some neurological condition. He now has to, and he's not atypical, he's got to obtain medical marijuana, which he says treats his condition better than any else, illegally.
Manages his pain.
Why are we still waiting after 23 months, and when will the waiting end?
Well, the waiting will end when the dispensaries, the applicants, have been fully vetted. We have licensed or provisional licenses in many counties, but not in every county, and there is frustration in the places where none of the applicants who applied in a given county were qualified. And there's a real tension here that at least as I experience it, between folks who want to hurry up and have the access that the people voted for 2 years ago, as you say, and making sure that the people who are in the business actually are the right people, are the people who say they are the people who have represented, you know, whose representations are in fact honest and accurate and above board, and that has proven to be a challenge.
What's your time? What's your sense? What can you say to people about when the first dispensary would open? Do you know?
Well, I think the time frame is before the end of the year for all of the ones who passed the vetting.
Are you frustrated with your own people on this?
Well, I'm frustrated by yes, I am. I mean, they know that. I think there was a tremendous effort to have a very thorough process where the public was shown what was happening at each stage of the process, and I think that was well intended, but turned out to have been fraught with the possibility of misunderstanding because they put out the list of the sort of first cut.
Yep.
And they hadn't finished all the vetting that was a part of the second cut. And they got faulted for not cutting folks in the first cut who would have been cut in the second. You remember all that?
Oh, of course,
I do remember
yeah.
And also I think there's an expectation that the public, I think quite reasonably, has that there will be a facility in every county. It will be convenient, but it's a market-based sort of strategy, which is to say, you make the licenses available, and you wait for eligible applicants to show up. And in some counties, none of the applicants were eligible, and that is a real source of frustration for a lot of people.
Every county,
right. Okay. But it doesn't say, right? It doesn't say bring the close enough qualified for every county to someone who's really qualified.
The frustration is this is over and over again in the emails that 2 years vetting seems just inexcusable, and that's the thrust of a lot of these emails.
Let's take one more call before we break. Governor DeVal Patrick.
Let's see. John is calling from Ipswich.
Hey, John.
Hello, Governor.
How are you, John? I get that a lot, by the way.
Hi, John.
I always wanted to say that.
I do get that a lot. Usually, though, from fifth and sixth graders.
Well, thank you.
He means that in the sweetest way. Go ahead.
I love the show, Jim and Margie.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
The welcome centers on the north-south highways, especially 95, are
they're
pathetic.
Nasty. Yeah.
Well, it seems like it could be a profit-generating center with the lease, with the restaurant and gas station.
Yeah.
Why are ours in such bad shape?
We actually put a bid out a few years ago, John, to get private managers, I guess, or to get a private entity to come in and take them over on the understanding they could use the additional space at the rest stops for shops and things like that as a revenue generator. So it was meant to be a public-private partnership, and the bids came back so low. Now, this was at a time when the economy was less robust than it is right now. But the bids came back so low, it didn't seem prudent to go ahead. But I do think that may be a strategy going forward.
Thank you very much for the call.
We are taking calls for the next hour. Governor Patrick's going to be with us until 1 o'clock. The conversation continues, 89.7 WGBH, the phone number 877-301-8970, or the email bpr@wgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. The governor, as in DeVal Patrick, is with us till 1 o'clock, as he is once a month. You can reach him directly at 877-301-8970. What's the email again, Marjorie?
Well, I gave out the wrong email. I apologize. It's at bpr@wgbh.org.
Governor.
Yes.
Let's take a call.
All right. Georgia is calling from Lynn. Georgia, are you there?
Apparently not. Let's we'll get back to Georgia. Don't go away. We'll put you on hold. Try another one. I'm sorry. Georgia is back. My apologies. Hi.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Georgia.
My name is Georgia. I'm calling from Lynn.
Hi.
Governor.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. Good. Listen, this might be off the subject that you're discussing this morning, but my concern is I have a sister who is serving a life term imprisonment at Framingham for a case for a crime that she did not commit.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister, she's been there for 26 years. Mm. Now, the person who murdered this, the person is already out. He only did 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister, she's still there. I'm in a process right now. I ripped up so many letters to you. I've been writing, a letter to you explaining, the situation and trying to get my sister, home to her family.
Mm-hmm.
Since she's been in prison, we lost like 5 or 6 family members that my sister has not even been here to grieve with us and be with us. My sister right now is 64 years old and she went in, like I said, 26 years ago, and the person who actually killed the person is only did 7 years, and they're holding my sister there against everything that we as a family has tried to do to help her out. We don't have a lot of money, so we don't have money to get the right lawyers and so forth. But, I myself, I'm 54, I don't even know what she looks like anymore.
Wow.
Georgia,
excuse me.
No, absolutely, you take it, Governor.
Georgia, has she applied for parole?
She did, and they keep denying her parole. My sister didn't murder this person. My sister was there at the time, but she didn't do it. They know that she didn't do it. And the person who actually did the killing, he only served 7 years, and my sister is still there in prison.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to and so the question is how do you get justice in your sister's case as you see it?
Yes, and I, like I said, I've been writing letters, and I don't know the right words to put on the letter.
I think you've gotten the point across. I mean, it's hard for me to give you advice about what the right outcome is without knowing more about the case. But I assume that your sister has had her appeals through the courts, and I think there are in the parole system the petition is what I'm trying to say. There's a parole petition process, and sometimes counsel are made available to help with those parole petition petitions. And if you would like us to see whether there is a public defender who could help with that, you can hang on. I'd be happy to try to refer it.
Georgia, stay on the line, please, and our colleagues will get a number. Can we stay on the subject for a minute?
Mm-hmm.
Have there been any pardons granted by you or
no.
commutations by you in
no.
7.5 years?
No.
Is that going to change in the final three
well,
months?
Well, it's interesting. I've gotten – so you know the way the process works?
A little, but you might want to explain.
So you get – I get recommendations through the
parole board?
The parole board serving in that capacity, recommending pardons or commutations. And I've gotten, I think, one in the last 7.5 years, and I said no to that one. I've been back at them, in fact, we recently changed the guidelines to encourage, really to make it easier for people to petition, because I'm ready, and I think the Governor's Council, which has to approve them, is ready within bounds. You know, I'm particularly – once upon a time I looked at whether there was a way to do a whole class of individuals, to commute the sentences of individuals who were convicted of nonviolent drug crimes, because in most of those cases the issue is better responded to by treatment than by incarceration. It's one of the causes of overcrowding in our prisons. It was very hard to figure out how to do them as a class because, in fact, people are different and their situations are different, and sometimes that one charge is tied up with a number of others, and it's hard to peel them apart.
So you encouraging – I mean, I want to read between the lines. You encouraging the parole board to send you things?
Yeah, yeah, oh, yeah. In fact, they've sent three
– three, I think is what I read.
I think I'm right. They've sent three either pardon or commutation recommendations, which I'm studying now.
And on very briefly, on commutation things, even if you're not willing to go the whole nine yards on something, would you consider a middle ground recommending, for example, somebody who might be there with life without parole, who maybe was involved in a joint enterprise, like it sounds like George's relative mm-hmm. was, maybe just recommending that they get a parole hearing or that sort of thing?
I mean, you don't have to use the pardon or commutation system for that, but that it does give me an opportunity to make the point. Not everything that is within a governor's power – what am I trying to say? The governor's power isn't limited to pardons. In other words, you can say, look, I'm not gonna pardon the crime, but I'm going to commute the sentence
understood.
To time served or something less than the original sentence. And there has to be a basis for that.
Understood. Let's go back to the calls, Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Celeste is calling from Framingham. Celeste, you there?
Hello, Celeste. Hello, Celeste. Oh, here she is. I'm sorry. We're having a little technical problem. But Celeste, you are now there. Is that correct?
Yes. Hi. Thank you.
Hi, Celeste.
Our apologies.
Hey.
Go ahead.
Governor, I wanted to invite you to make a lasting legacy in the criminal justice system here in Massachusetts by pushing through salary increases for public defenders and prosecutors before you leave office.
Okay. I mean, I hope you know I'm with you. I don't know whether you know the back and forth with the legislature at the end of the last budget season.
I'm aware of it, yeah.
And I asked for
–
sorry?
I'm hoping you're continuing to push as much as you can for it.
I think it's the right thing to do. I think the right time to have done it is when the DA's salaries were increased, and I think we could have afforded it. I think it is It is possible, but candidly, Celeste, I think only a remote possibility that the legislature will do a sup budget, that a supplementary budget that includes funding for public defender salary increases right now before the end of the year, because most of that kind of work is done in is not done in the so-called informal session where anyone. Legislator can object. They try to do things that are non-controversial. And while I wouldn't say this is controversial, I think it would probably require some debate. But I take your point, and I'm with you, and I will do what I can.
Thank you very much for the call.
The salaries are only about $35,000, $40,000, $45,000.
Aren't we dead last in the country?
I think we might be.
I don't know how you are supposed to come out of law school, you know, $120,000 in debt and then go to work as a public defender or an assistant district attorney. You can't do it.
Well, the assistant DA's the DA's salaries just got increased, and they should have been. That was the right thing to do. I want to say the assistant DAs too. I want to.
Yeah.
I should check that to make sure I'm right. But the public defenders play as vital a role, and it's time for us to consider whether they are paid fairly.
You get some good news. Good news on community colleges. Secretary Duncan was here. What happened?
Secretary Duncan, the U.S. Education Secretary, and Secretary Perez, the U.S. Labor Secretary, who, by the way, used to work for me in the Justice Department.
Oh, really?
Great, great guy. We're here in Springfield yesterday. I wasn't able to be with them, but they came up to draw attention to the national challenge of having our community colleges more connected with meeting the workforce needs, particularly middle skills needs in our economy. And they came to Massachusetts because we've done some really good work over the last few years to make that connection. And they were out in Springfield in the company of the Springfield Technical Community College, which is one of the best in our system in readying both young people and mid-career folks for the jobs in advanced manufacturing and other technical skills, but in middle skills at the middle skills level for the jobs that are available. And there was a marvelous testimonial I heard about a fellow who I think was in his late 40s or 50s and had been who spoke at the event yesterday and had been laid off from a job he'd been in for a long time and had gone to STIC and gotten a certificate in the area of in an area related to precision manufacturing, is in an $80,000 or $85,000 job now, and you know, it's making a difference in his life.
We're talking to Governor Deval Patrick, as are you, till 1 o'clock. Governor, you were the newspapers reported that the other day there was this, I don't know if you call it a pep rally, a rally of sorts for those who want to bring the Olympics to Boston in 2024. And you had a conflict, or you would have been there. So let me ask you a question or two about that, if I
about the Olympics.
About the Olympics, yeah. John,
and then I'm going to come back to the wastewater treatment.
Why don't you actually do that? Because you have
can
the
I
answer.
Do that now?
Absolutely, please
so
do.
So for the, I can't remember the name of the.
Nor
of
can
the
I. My our apologies. The woman who called asking if essentially that things like feces and urine that
in wastewater, human
yes.
waste and wastewater.
Yeah, can that
and
lead
that
to
a
Ebola
is that a risk? And here is what the CDC and the DPH say, the Department of Public Health. Ebola does not pose a risk in water treatment. Modern sewage treatment plants are designed to handle the treatment of infectious diseases, including Ebola. This was an example provided by the doctor HHS talked to today. He said specifically that the virus is not, quote, hardy, so quote, close quote, so it is highly unlikely that it could sustain itself in sewage.
Thank you for that.
That's a
so,
comfort.
So, Governor, back to the Olympics if we can for a second. John Fish, who's running, was sort of in charge of this thing,
yeah.
Was here, was on television with me, and he made some assurances around the financial front, which is, I think, probably the greatest reservation that some people have. One, he said not a penny of public money would be spent during the bidding process leading up to the United States Olympic Committee selection in January.
Right.
Two, he said actually not a penny of public money would be spent even through the ultimate selection by the International Olympic Committee. He said not another dollar would have to be spent by the public on transportation infrastructure that was not, quote, already in the pipeline. Is that your understanding that all three of those representations
that is
are
my understanding? And let me can I go to the last
one? You can
one?
Do, go wherever
I
you
think
want to go.
The last one is really important. For me, As exciting as it would be to have the Olympics here, and I think it would be, the fact that we are pursuing that, I think, is hugely important because it means we're prepared to assert ourselves on the international stage. And I think it's important for the greater Boston area and the Commonwealth to let its light shine, to let our light shine. It's important economically and socially. It's great to create the buzz. On a practical level, the should we win the bid, the impetus to finish the transportation plan that we proposed, what was it now, four years ago, is huge. And there, the public would have to invest, but in things that the public has already said they want. And the opportunity to generate the support of the business community, both in dollar terms and in encouraging the legislature to make those investments, I think is also top drawer. So those are the reasons why I'm enthusiastic.
But are you not worried that it seems to me the most critical assurance that's got to be made is that if there's ever a cost overrun, if we get this thing and we secure it and we do the Olympics, that not a penny of that is paid by the public.
I think that's right.
Are you comfortable? This bid is going to be decided, at least the U.S. part, in January. Do you have any comfort level that you or John Fish will be able to make that representation of the people by January?
I think you have to make that representation. First of all, there is no public money involved in competing for the U.S. bid, as John Fish said. There need be no public money in competing for the international bid. The public's money, if any, would also not be involved in building any of the venues for it. And there's lots of private interest in that, so I don't think the public's going to need to be involved. But the connectivity of all of it depends on a first-rate transportation system. And you know what? Boston and the Commonwealth need and deserve a first-rate transportation system.
Governor, back to the calls.
Sure. Let's see. Is it Mario? Mario, are you calling from Worcester?
Hello.
Hi, Mario.
Yes.
Hi. How are you?
Hi, Governor. Let me say, first of all, I believe you've done a great job for Massachusetts.
Thank you.
And sorry to see you go.
Thank you. I feel a butt coming.
Yes. I just want to point out one shortcoming of the criminal justice system I had the opportunity to experience because it happened to the son of a friend of mine.
Yes.
In Massachusetts, when you get arrested, you can get arrested for anything. You could be in the wrong place at the wrong time, you know, and even though you're not charged with anything or your case never goes to court or charges get dropped or whatever, your arrest record stays with you. Now, what that causes a lot of hardship and pain, because nowadays with the internet and all that, people can check your record. Mm-hmm. They see you have an arrest, they've been arrested, and it prevents you from getting jobs for the rest of your life. It would seem to me that, you know, under the principle that you're innocent until proven guilty, that you should not be subjected to this clause. I mean, why should an arrest record that amounts to no crime being committed be on your record?
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything being done?
Well, the principal record, criminal justice record, is called the Corey record, as part of the Corey system. And we reformed the Corey system 4 years ago now, Mario, to address precisely this sort of thing. The information, all of an individual's information about any contact with the criminal justice system is forever available to law enforcement. But other information that isn't relevant to your here and now is not publicly available. And if you're was it your friend's son, Mario? Is that who he said?
Yes. He applied for a government job, and they told him they could not consider his application because he had an arrest record, even though it was never, you know, the charges were dropped
right.
and everything.
Well, many of these rules have been changed in the last couple of years. If you want to hang on and let us get some contact information for you or for your friends, son, so that we can have somebody get into his Corey record and make sure that it is up to date. I'm happy to do that.
Mario, don't go away. One of our producers will take your number, and the governor's office will be in touch. Thank you, Mario, for the call.
Governor Patrick, you've been a strong supporter out on the campaign trail for Martha Coakley. She's the attorney general that's running for governor, a very close race with Charlie Baker. I think I read in one of these stories you thought Charlie Baker was a little bit too self-centered. You recall some of the things that went on back in 2010 you didn't like much. So please feel free.
Let her rip.
What didn't you like much in 2010, and why are you helping Martha Coakley? She's a Democrat, obviously.
That's not the only reason, although I'm proud to be a Democrat. I would tell you Democrats get on my last nerve. But I think Martha Coakley is exactly what we need at this moment, and I think Democrats have chosen wisely to nominate her, and I hope that the people of the Commonwealth choose wisely in electing her governor. And it has a lot to do with the fact that this isn't 2010. This isn't about yesterday, looking in and looking back. It's about looking out and looking forward. And, I've said more times, so many times, that you roll your eyes when I say it, but the reason I ran in the first place is because I feel so strongly about the importance of governing for the next generation, and not for the next election cycle or the next news cycle. It's not about the candidate or the office holder. It's about all of us. And there's only one candidate in this race whose policies and whose life experience has been about the next generation, and that's Martha Coakley.
Marty Walsh and Michael Capuano said that Charlie Baker would be a good governor, even though they are supporting Martha Coakley. Do you think Charlie Baker would be a good governor?
Well, look, this is more, I think, about why Martha is right than why Charlie is wrong. But to the point about governing for the long term and making wise choices now that are good for us over time, contrast a proposal around universal pre-K, universally understood from basic research to have a high impact on a generation of learners, an enormously important thing at a time when the economy is in the midst of a knowledge explosion, to Charlie Baker's record in the public sector, where he came up with the Big Dig financing scheme and then hid it purposefully, leaving it, for me and others to try to clean up. And then the sort of, to me, sort of icing on the cake is that, he now campaigns to undo the gas tax, which is part of the fix for the starving of our roads and bridges and basic maintenance and upkeep that Big Dick scheme created.
But what's wrong
with
this position that if people in the legislature, duly elected, want to raise the gas tax to help fix and expand the infrastructure, they should just vote for it?
Because they did. In the same way they voted to index the income tax, in the same way that their salaries are indexed. You don't hear them say, well, we indexing is bad, so let's not index the income tax. And by the way, because of that indexing, the income tax has gone down each of the last two cycles and is on track to go down again.
You're going to campaign actively for Coakley in addition to when asked to answer the question?
Yeah. In fact, I'm going out to Northampton this afternoon, and then I'm going to be with Martha Coakley in Worcester this evening. So, yeah, I'm doing as much as I can, consistent with my day job.
You know, one last thing on this. The things you have been criticized for in your government, when you've been the governor, the things that didn't go well, DCF, I mean, DCF struggles in a lot of administrations. It struggled in yours, or the mess up with the drug place where the convictions were overturned and all that kind of stuff.
Annie Dukin,
that's right. So, thank you. Is that Baker has shown himself to be a better manager because of Harvard Pilgrim, the Big Dig you cited is one of his big failures, than Martha Coakley, who's not really managed that much. And so what's your counter to that argument?
Well, I guess the first thing I'd say is I don't think this election is about management. You can hire a COO. It's not about me. We had that election 4 years ago. It's about tomorrow. And about a vision for the future, a direction for the Commonwealth, and the ability to enforce it. I will say that no matter who the governor is, there are going to be problems, right? And the question is, are you going to find, face, and fix those problems, as we have in each of those cases and others? Or are you going to contrive a solution, then hide the problem, which is what his record in public life has shown? So we had a more than bumpy rollout of the website, but what we did was dig in, diagnose the problem, fix it. We didn't just go with a sort of ritual resignations, which make great TV and radio, but not necessarily great long-term and lasting solutions.
Let's try to squeeze one more call in for Governor Deval Patrick. And by the way, if he doesn't get to you, if you stay on the line, we will take your phone number and his office will be in touch. Governor.
Let's see. Abdullah is calling from Medford.
Hi, Abdullah.
Hello, Governor. Thank you. I like the show, Marjorie. And now we have 3 hours.
Yes. I know, we do.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Yep, and
they want you to keep talking about that.
That's right.
Go ahead, Abdullah.
And I'm calling to thank the governor. I want to thank a great job that you've done for this state. And yes, you've proved that we can change. That was the slogan for your first election campaign. I remember when you assumed the corner office, the Hill was more of a hostile, making a joke of that slogan than welcoming. But you proved to be right, and I just want to thank you what you've done financially. I mean, we are top of the state when it comes to financial strongly, and also amazed at how you succeeded to unify the three agencies, transportation agencies, that was basically draining the state and making a one transportation agency there.
Thank you. Thank you. Well,
thank you, Abdullah.
We've had a good team, both within the administration, a good partnership with the legislature, great help from the business community, from advocates, and from a whole lot of folks who didn't care about their own civic and political life. And I'm proud of the record. You know, there's obviously always more work to do, but that focus on the next generation, as I say, rather than, the next election, I think has made a difference here. I hope it has.
We only have 30 seconds left. Do you have a job yet?
Not yet.
I'm serious. Have you been talking to people about employment?
No, you know, people flirt, but, you know, you can't really have a conversation while you're in the job, consistent with the rules. And so I've been keeping people at appropriate arm's length.
But have you thought, I mean, do you say to yourself, and this will be brief, don't worry, if time's almost up, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a public speaker.
I want to be an author.
I really know that's your ultimate dream. Yeah. But have you thought about what it is, the kind of work you want to do come January? Or no?
I'm starting to think about it more. I'm mostly thinking about what trip I'm going to take with Diane on January 8th at noon.
I think you're a fine interior decorator, and Governor Deval Patrick, I remember your initial Christmas party at your house was pretty impressive, and I heard you did it all yourself. Anyway.
Who told you that?
I think you did.
Governor
Deval Patrick joins us every month for Ask the Governor. Next month will be his penultimate appearance with us in this capacity, so take it for granted. Up next, it's time for Open Mic with Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam and his gripe about writers not earning a decent wage, plus Judge Ruth Bader Ginsburg's exercise routine. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston Online at WGBHnews.org, Boston's local NPR station. Joining us, he does every Thursday for Open Mic, is Alex Beam. And as we do every time he's here, we marvel that his name is Alex Beam. Correct, Marjorie?
Correct, Jim.
Thank you, because his writing, like a loaf of sunbeam bread, is always fresh. Alex, it's a pleasure.
There's literally nothing at the center. There's no core there at all.
That was my point, too.
It has no nutritional value.
Alex, it's great intellectual
value. I love sunbeam bread, Alex. I just want you to know that.
Thank you.
So we know that you're kind of a curmudgeonly guy and you don't
really?
You hate everybody.
Oh.
But last time you were here, you said that you did like book signings. Can you please tell us why that is?
Well, no, the question – I do like – book signing. What I said was, if you gave me half an hour, I'd rail against authors who don't like book tours. Because I used to be the kind of author who was nowhere near a book tour. I published two novels in the late 80s, early 90s, and I mean, and then I would read these long articles by authors complaining, oh, I've got to go on book tour. I've got to go to six cities, stay in really nice hotels, have incredibly beautiful, like, junior publicists, whom I, by the way, tend to sleep with, you know, take me around
really?
To all these adulatory book signings, public radio interviews where, like, no one's read the book, so they don't ask me any critical questions. Mm-hmm. And go, your new book is selling really well. It must be good. It just really made me bristle. So I have had, you know, it's nice to be halfway up the great food ladder of writerdom.
Okay.
And so, yeah, I do go to events. I get invited to events. I like to do events.
And you like talking to real people. I understand the event and the reading portion. Now, the part that does not fit your MO, and I mean this as respectfully as one can, the notion that you enjoy exchanges with real people at these things is a little hard for me to fathom. Am I on base there or am I not, Alex Beam?
Well, real people is a very, very broad term.
But you know what I mean? Okay. Somebody would actually come to a reading of, what's the name of your current book?
How to Do Yoga in 12 Easy. Okay. Oh, the one about the Mormons.
Crucifixion, the murder of Joseph Smith,
American
and the fate of the Mormon Church.
Yeah.
All this good feeling. Enough of this good feeling.
Exactly.
You are seething, because we know this, about all these authors. We read your column that make a lot of money. That you're seething because you haven't made a lot of money.
No, I wrote a column a while back, but from which I'm trying to deflect attention, because I'd always wanted to write a column based on something that my father told me when I was like 15 years mm-hmm. old, was he held out a book a neighbor had written, and he said, there's no money in books. And my entire life, I've always wanted to answer the question, how did my dad know that? It's quite literally true. There is no money in books. Herman Melville famously called himself damned by dollars, a kind of unforgettable phrase, because as is, you know, widely known, I mean, the examples are almost too numerous. I mean, Moby Dick was a catastrophic failure when it was published. Henry David Thoreau, not known for his wit, once amusingly said, I am surrounded in my house by works of my own creation. Those were actually unsold copies of Walden, which had a printing of 700, about 23 of which sold. I mean,
and Shakespeare did die wealthy. You mentioned this in your column in April, but not because of his writing. Is that correct?
He was a very canny investor, uh-huh. a real estate investor, and also had skin in the game. He owned a portion of the Globe.
Yeah. You know, speaking of Herman Melville, if I could do a dramatic reading, if you don't mind. This is a letter to
the
editor.
Sperm whale?
This is a letter to the editor from in response to Alex's column in April,
whining.
Writing is bad
whining.
For your wealth. Yet I – poor Alex Beam. He's not yet rich. Yet I am guessing he lives in a fine and stately home, probably made of brick. Do you?
Yes. It's half brick. Okay,
in
fine.
One of Boston's leafy semi-suburbs, Brookline, Newton? Newton, yes.
Ouch.
Drives a
Ouch.
Good Japanese car, a hybrid. Do you?
Yes,
okay,
I do.
Fine.
Okay, fine.
With less than 1,000 miles in the odometer, plays squash regularly at an understated but not inexpensive club, and sends his kids to excellent liberal arts institutions of higher learning, all for writing funny and incisive columns for the Globe. Herman Melville never had it so good, and it's signed by somebody whose name people might recognize, David Updike, who just happens to be the son of one particular writer.
John
who
Updike,
did
and he's also
well.
A writer himself, David Updike.
He's a terrific guy, by the way. His kid went to the same school my kid did.
Right,
he's terrific.
In your place.
Yeah, it was unbelievable for someone who claimed not to. Almost every fact. I've become a Facebook friend of his, so we know what that means. It could mean anything. But and he claims there was a typo in that hilarious kind of put down letter, because I told him, yes, I drive a Prius, but it has 114,000 miles on it. It's not a low mileage Prius.
For you.
So anyway, he claims like the Globe butchered his letter.
But in all seriousness, about this, authors can't make money for the most part. When you start a project, how long did it take you to write the Joseph Smith book? A couple of years?
2 years, right. And I was paid 1 year's worth of income.
And do you say to yourself, I mean this seriously, Alex, is it hard to fight through the notion that even though the work matters to you, and obviously I assume your highest priority is putting a high quality piece of work that you're proud of out, does it trouble you that at the end of the day you're likely not to profit in a serious way from 2 years
He's
of
in great
sweat
company,
and tears
though.
And that
He's
sort
in
of
great
thing?
Company.
No, I'm not criticizing you for it. I'm asking you, how hard is that to work through that?
Well, it's not hard at all, because you're doing the book because you want to do the book.
Right.
Okay. I think I've even said before, literally in this program, I mean, the real privilege is to work on a book that you want to write. I mean, a lot of people don't have that privilege. A lot of people have to, you know, write because the mortgage is due. Dostoevsky had to write, you know, because he needed money. I mean,
wasn't it Scott Fitzgerald? Didn't he die pretty broke even after the Great Gatsby? He didn't sell as much in his lifetime. How about the guy that did the Confederacy of Dunces? Remember that book like about
25 years
ago? Well,
John Kennedy O'Toole was never published in his lifetime. His mom got Walker Percy to publish it. I hate to interrupt you, but you know what's much more interesting about
it? Didn't he kill himself, the Confederacy of Dunces guy?
Say that again?
The Confederacy of Dunces guy, I think he killed himself.
Confederacy of Dunces,
yeah, he committed suicide. Yeah. His mom eventually sold his manuscript, or, you know, sort of marketed his manuscript to Walker Percy.
But what was your point you were about to make?
I wanted to make a totally unrelated point, much more interesting than the status of the financial status of F. Scott Fitzgerald when he died, was that he was not allowed a Catholic burial.
Why not?
I don't know. That's a good question.
By the way,
he
is speaking to the spirituality columnist of
CruxNow.com
at the Boston Globe.
You know what's even worse? No, it was even worse. I don't know what you thought of the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo series, but they did sell enormously, and it was a page turner. Remember what happened to him? He finally gets an okay in his books. He runs up the stairs to tell his girlfriend, and he drops dead.
Yeah, but he was killed by the Croatian mob. Everyone knows that.
You think so?
Absolutely.
You need to
read the Swedish press.
Oh, really?
Hey, Alex. Speaking of great writers. Nobel Prize for Literature has been awarded. Do you know the guy?
Patrick Modiano. Yeah, he was at my house. We were smoking Gauloises last week.
You ever read anything of his?
No, I haven't.
You have not? Okay.
But who has?
Right. I had never heard of him.
Okay. But I do have a footnote for your listeners.
What's that, please?
They saw the movie, the famous Louis Malle movie, La Combe Lucien.
Oh, and that accent.
And Modiano wrote the screenplay. So that your listeners actually have a point of tangency with Patrick Modiano.
Now, we're talking to Alex Beam from the Boston Globe. Alex, you're actually interested in something that is a current event as opposed to abstract. You, I believe, want to weigh in on the so-called stoner defense of Robel Philippos. And by the way, we're going to talk more about Philippos tomorrow and the whole issue of whether or not the U.S. attorney needed to charge this young man the way she did. You should read Yvonne Abraham's great column in the Globe
it
today.
It enraged me.
The contention in this case is, at least from his defense attorneys, is he was, quote, high out of his mind, remembered nothing. Now, by the way, if that's true, then he obviously didn't have the criminal intent to do what he did, allegedly lie to the FBI. Why are you making a face about this?
Well, because I wanted to talk about this in the context of The Cannabist, which is my new favorite publication. I think it's published by the Denver Post.
Mm-hmm.
It's as the Boston Globe has Crux, which is devoted to Roman
all
Catholicism.
All things Catholic,
yeah.
Yes.
The Denver Post has a new publication called The Cannabist, which
is
obviously because the people there on the ballot in Washington State legalized recreational marijuana.
Yeah. What really disappoints me about the Globe coverage of this guy. Who was too? Is it they didn't use the term hotboxing? I think I had to find that somewhere else.
Philippos, you're talking about.
Yeah, Philippos. Yeah. I think he and his pals were hotboxing, which refers to lighting up a bunch of joints inside a car with the windows up,
mm-hmm.
so that you're constantly recirculating the
really?
Smoke. Yeah, even Marjorie's
how
Lord,
clever.
I can tell. She's thinking, why didn't I know that?
I thought you were reacting to the bourgeois woman who the New York Times wrote the article about, who wanted to be a sort of high-end luxury pot store.
Well, the Cannabist magazine took
those two
down. Because their quote is they're trying to, quote, weed out the stoners.
That's a great line.
It's a great, let's see, because you see yourself picking seeds out of the marijuana. Whoa.
And my
not that we ever did anything like that.
How about this guy for the cannabis staff? I was heartened having inhaled once or twice way back when in college, of course.
Yeah.
This guy, Neil Pollack, who is the chief guy that says...
Their new columnist.
Their new columnist, who apparently smoked pot nonstop since he was born. Nonetheless, he was a 3-time Jeopardy champion, and he's written 9 books. 8 of them semi-best-selling books. So
yeah, several
go.
Of them self-published. I think he's one of these notable McSweeney's self-promoters.
Oh, he is.
Yeah, but but on this he's spot on. He said he claims to have been smoking marijuana longer than the 2 marketing women in the New York Times have been alive. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, no. He says like I mean it's going to be very interesting. I mean I'm sorry we're not talking about Jokhar Tsarnaev anymore. But, I mean, this looks like a really fascinating cultural divide developing between, like, the old stoner culture and the fake medical marijuana dispensaries on Venice Beach. You know, now they're calling these, what's it called, mindful? There's a new dispensary, sort of pot store. You're not even supposed to call it pot anymore.
Oh, you're not?
Yeah, you're not supposed to say smoke it. You consume it. It's called cannabis, not pot. And the store, instead of being called, like, you know, Dr. John's, is now called Gaia, which is, like, hilarious.
You know, you mentioned, you said you were not talking talking about Jahar Tsarnaev anymore, and though we didn't intend to, just for a second, I haven't talked to Marjorie about this either. The judge in that case, O'Toole, and this is not, please don't send emails suggesting there is any sympathy in the studio in any way for the younger Tsarnaev brother, denied a venue change in this case. And I don't know if you read what Judge O'Toole had to say, which I would say, with all due respect to the judge, was borderline moronic. He dismisses the change in venue in the Tim McVeigh case, the Oklahoma City bombing, which I think is totally relevant, to a footnote. And he then says, proof of the fact, I just want your reaction, is proof of the fact, and I'm paraphrasing, proof of the fact that you can get a fair trial even in a venue like this where people know a lot and passions are high, is the trial of Sal DeMasi, former Speaker of the House, Jack O'Brien, former Probation Commissioner, and Whitey Bulger. And what I think he failed to mention is all three of them were convicted, so how would he know that they got a fair trial? Well, even if there was a comparison.
In terms of notoriety.
Exactly, but even if there was a fair comparison, how does he know that they got a fair trial in light of the fact that all three of them were convicted?
Well, suppose, I don't understand the distinction you're making. Suppose they'd been released, would that be proof
that
they got a fair trial?
No, I think it's totally irrelevant. I think the relevant case that he relegated to a footnote was Tim McVeigh. Is there any way, for those who don't know.
You guys both seem to have, what are both of you?
You don't have to not know anything about the case. You don't have to not have an opinion about the case. You just need to be able to say to the court, I can judge this fairly based on the evidence. How can they judge this case fairly?
I completely disagree with you.
In a Boston courtroom.
I sort of disagree with you.
Why?
I do too. I think the jurors take their business extremely seriously.
In a case like this that affected people as directly as this?
I argue that the entire nation knows everything about, maybe not.
The entire nation does not have somebody they know, either a family member or a neighbor, who was immediately and directly affected by this bombing. It's very different.
Being at the marathon is not the same as having your leg lost at the
marathon. I agree, but it's being at the marathon as opposed to being, let's say, in Washington, D.C. when you weren't at the marathon.
I think the people that were at the marathon will probably not be sitting on the jury. They will be weeded out in the voir dire.
Yeah, you agree with Marjorie on this?
Why? You're too deep into the Globe headlines here. Yeah. I mean, more people died on 495 last week. I mean, I know that's a very unpopular thing to say. I mean, this whole, city scarred, I don't know, you're a little deep
into
it.
By the way, I share your perspective on that, and I know it's a dangerous thing to say in this community.
It is a dangerous thing
to say,
but
that's not my point. My point is, focusing on this one case, at least to me, it is not credible, in my estimation, to argue that jurors can put this aside.
Okay, can we move on? Because I want to talk about something that I'm really interested in.
Go ahead.
This piece about the SAT scores, because Jim and I disagree vehemently about this as well. And it talks about how SAT scores and the income inequality factor, how wealthier kids rank higher. And I maintain that one of the reasons wealthy. Are you looking at me like you don't know what I'm talking about?
I always do that. We're on radio. I can make any face
can.
I want. Okay. Okay, thank you.
That one of the reasons wealthy
I'm taking
kids
my shirt
rank
off
higher
if I have
is
to.
Because wealthier kids' parents have the wherewithal to go out and get them SAT tutors so they can all take these courses and study these classes for these tests like crazy. I think that kids should be able to get these classes as I did in high school with a teacher who helped you prepare for the SATs because it matters in getting into college. And if you're not wealthy, you don't have access to that preparation.
Well, what we're talking about for context was on the New York Times website, I believe. It's one of their
Wall Street Journal.
Excuse me, Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. And it's on an economics blog. And it directly correlates almost point by point parental income to
yes.
SAT achievement.
It's outrageous.
Yeah. I must say, I don't 100% agree with you. I know that SAT tutoring is almost de rigueur in the well-to-do suburbs, very much like the one I live in, and every affluent suburb. I actually think, part of the correlation, and I think you would agree with me, and this isn't a very sophisticated point, is the sort of acculturation of the boy or girl from age 4
That's
to
true
14,
too. That's absolutely true.
Like
too.
The fact that the TV isn't on at supper time, or people talk about the books they read. I mean, so
this is one of the reasons, by the way, why many colleges, including places like the University of California system, are either de-emphasizing or eliminating. Not only because of the influence of, as they say in this article, it should be called the student affluence test, not student aptitude test. Not only because of those inequities, but that it's not a good predictor of future success, either in college or post-college.
We always talk about this philosophically. philosophically, right now, if you are a poor kid in a poor school, you have no preparation for these tests. To me, it's a disgrace. And I went to a school where in my high school, they trained you for the SATs and math and English, and people's scores went up from the pre-SATs.
So we should do more teaching in the tests in schools because we don't do enough now for MCAS
and
things like that?
Until we decide that we're going to get rid of SATs.
You were fortunate. I mean, you know, even college guidance is being de-emphasized. You know, schools can't afford high-quality college guidance and so on and so on and so on. I mean, and as we know, your point is actually quite apt because
pointing at me, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, even so-called affirmative action programs can't select out anymore for socioeconomic factors. So, you know, you're getting, you know, extremely well-to-do boys and girls of color. In other words, it's very hard. Colleges are now desperate to reach statistically below the socioeconomic norm of their average student.
Okay, your time has come. Here is the moment that most of you, some of you, a few of you have waited for. This is called Alex Beam's 45-second explainer. We give him a question, something in the news or something that needs explanation, and in 45 seconds or less, he attempts to explain this thing, and we're really up against it, so today it's got to be 45. The topic we've chosen is 81-year-old cancer survivor and Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has an exercise regimen that apparently is making her quite healthy and quite well as an octogenarian. Could you please explain it starting now?
Okay, you just have to cut me off in mid-sentence because I'm just going to be raving. Her exercise regimen is called the Royal Canadian Air Force Exercises. Mm-hmm. You can Google.
Love it.
XBX or 5BX. They were invented by Bill Orban, who of all things attended the University of California, Berkeley on a hockey scholarship. He is, in fact, Canadian. Who knew Cal had a hockey team?
Who knew?
My mom graduated. She never told me. He got a PhD from the University of Illinois, and he joined the Canadian Air Force. And the big deal was one-third of the airmen were unfit to fly, and B, of course, the Canadian Air Force is basically all above the Arctic Circle. No exercise equipment. He designed these incredibly short and intense regimens of exercise. One very important proof of concept, you must Google Helen Mirren, red bikini, Italy.
Yes.
Helen Mirren at age 62.
She
does the RCAF exercises, the most beautiful woman alive. As long as and Bill Orban, by the way, also died at a very healthy age. 81 years old, and his book sold like 18 million copies.
Can I tell you something? I don't mean to criticize you because you're one of my favorite columnists. You need to know when to end a column or a thing. If you don't end with Helen Mirren in a red bikini, you don't know endings.
I thought you were going to cut me off. You promised to cut me off.
Alex Beam, you were excellent.
Okay,
that was 54 seconds.
He's
did it quite well. It's beautiful. It's great to see you.
It's a great picture.
We had to rush through this. Alex Beam is a brilliant columnist for the Boston Globe. His latest book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith, and The Fate of the Mormon Church.
And you're doing a reading in Arlington, are you?
Arlington. High School Media Center, 7:30 this evening.
7:30 today?
Yeah,
great.
So excited about it. He's going to be very charming to everybody who comes.
Great to see you, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Up next, the Earth has lost half its wildlife in the past 4 decades. Are any of these years Nobel Prize winners working to stop this mass extinction? WGBH's Heather Goldstone joins us for that discussion on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Earlier today, we were mocking. Well, I don't know if I should say we were mocking people, but we were talking about the those who are outraged by the Earth by a 12-year-old dog who was killed because of Ebola, while showing virtually no comparable outrage for the death of Thomas Duncan, who died from Ebola. But when it comes to the animal kingdom, that's what I'm trying to say. We will concede that it's justified to get very upset by the fact that, and this is accurate, the Earth lost half of its wildlife in the past 4 decades. It is stunning. Joining us to talk about this and to make the Nobel Prize connection is GBH's Heather Goldstone. Heather's an expert in ocean science. Hello, Heather.
Hello.
Well, let's start with the Nobel Prizes. You know, how does this happen, by the way? Do people get called on the phone, and how do they pick them, and who's made the most brilliant discovery of the year? How does it work?
Okay, so with regard to getting notified, yeah, they're supposed to get a phone call. And actually, this year, there are a couple of great stories about the secondhand and odd ways that winners got notified. It seems that a number of the winners this year were at conferences, and so they didn't get the usual early morning, if you're in the U.S., phone calls. You know, there are all these stories of, I got woken up at 3 a.m. because I was in California and they're calling from Europe. But in one case, a person was on a plane when the decision was made, and actually got off the plane not knowing that he'd won the prize yet. His cell phone kind of exploded when he turned it back on. It was full of messages and calls, and an agent greeted him at the gate saying, "Congratulations on the prize."
Oh, that's great.
Wow.
What?
Wow.
Who's that, by the way? Who was that?
Was, I believe, one of the chemistry winners. Another one was at a conference and was supposed to be giving a talk, and I don't know if he ever actually got to give the talk he was supposed to, because he was then consumed by the media wanting to talk about him winning the Nobel Prize. Another one was actually at a conference in Brazil, and his wife was apparently notified by the AP, and then she then called her husband in Brazil to let him know. So all sorts of crazy ways about how people actually got told that they'd won this year.
You know, there's one thing that particularly fascinated me, this whole inner GPS device. This was in, I think, a couple. Is this one with the couple that got the inner GPS deal, or is that somebody else?
What would they win the prize for?
The Nobel Prize in Medicine this year, two of the three winners. So all of the prizes this year were shared three ways, and that's actually been the trend recently. The prize cannot go to more than three people. That's stipulated.
If four people worked on the thing, they pick three of the four?
We'll get to that in a minute, because this is part of why I love Nobel Week. All right. I actually don't love Nobel Week for the science. I mean, that's part of it. But I love it for all the drama. And so we'll get to that, because there's definitely a story of the person who should have gotten it who didn't this year. Actually, there's a couple of those. But for the prize in medicine and physiology, split three ways. Part of it went to one person for the discovery of what are called place cells in the brain, basically the neurons, the cells in our brain that help us figure out where we are in the world. And then the other two-thirds went to this married couple, Edvard and Maybrit Moser, for the discovery of cells called grid cells that help us kind of put that place within a larger framework. And the science itself is considered very important. It could help us understand how, say, people with Alzheimer's lose where they are, and just generally how we create maps in our head. But what was interesting to me is that this was only the fourth time in Nobel history that a married couple had split a prize. And here's your pop quiz. Can you name the first couple?
Well, it's got to be what's called the Curies.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So the first couple was Marie and Pierre Curie. The second couple was the Curie's daughter and her husband. And then in the was it the late 40s, I believe, there was a couple who actually won for a medical discovery of how part of our metabolism works. But what was really interesting to me about this is that the first three women to win Nobels all share in science, I should say. In literature and peace, it's totally different. But in the sciences, the first three women to win a Nobel Prize all split them with their husband. Marie Curie also went on to win one of her own a few years later. But I think it tells you something really sociological about how these women were kind of having to get into science. And in the case of Marie and Pierre Curie, he was a stunning scientist of his own right. But radiation was really her interest that he moved into as a result of her interest. And so it kind of tells you something. And then those shared prizes disappear for a few decades as women start to come into science of their own right. And then we're back into a new phase where I think you're seeing in the past 10 to 20 years, and I myself am one of these two scientist couples, where you've got women coming into graduate school wanting a career in science of their own, and at a critical point in your life where you're meeting the people who could potentially become your partner, you're hanging out with a bunch of other scientists, and you're seeing increasingly what people like to joke is the two-body problem. That's actually a real physics problem, but the problem of then having two scientists with careers
in
one family.
Something? I don't care about these married couples. What I care about is what you touched on before. Four people do something that changes the world in physics, whatever it is. Three of them are recognized for the Nobel Prize, and one of them is not?
Okay.
What is that about?
It's stipulated in Alfred Nobel's gift
that
to
only
create
three
these prizes.
People can
the
share?
Prize can only be split three ways. And I think that's probably, it's a set amount of money. It's $1.2 million. You start splitting it a gazillion ways, and obviously it makes very little impact on any one person.
You keep the money. I want the recognition.
But exactly. There's the prestige factor. And so the one that's really got people, I mean, with the prize in physics on Tuesday went to three people who helped develop the blue LED.
Mm-hmm.
And
the
that
blue
was,
as opposed to another color?
Well, right. So okay. here's where it gets kind of interesting. So what you need to make a white LED, like all the lights we now have around our homes and buildings, that makes this really important, a really important application, is you have to have red and green and blue. Now, red was discovered in 1962, green a little bit after that. It was then 30 years before anybody could make a blue LED that made it possible to really exploit this technology. And it's the people who were able to create the blue LED that got the Nobel. with no mention of the person who discovered the red LED, the first LED, back in 1962.
I am outraged and I don't even know anything about
it. He is still alive. He is a former Indiana University professor, and he actually got a bit stroppy when he heard that.
What did he say? I love this. What did he say?
He basically said, you know, you're going to give all the credit to the slave who put the last stone on top of a pyramid without any credit to those who came before and put all the other preceding, you know, and actually I said something to the effect of, you know, what the hell are you people thinking? So he's obviously
I love that he spoke out, by the way. But wait a second. How about my example? Four people or a whole lab are equally involved in a discovery that changes everything in medicine, whatever. Three, how do they pick? Okay. How do they decide who the three
must
are?
Must make them very happy in the lab on the following day.
Exactly.
And it happens every single year. And this year, so we got to Tuesday with the prize for the LED, and I thought, is this as controversial as it's going to get? You know, they chose the discovery that made it possible to exploit it and not the first discovery. And then we got to yesterday and things really blew up because the prize went to three different scientists who had independently come up with a way of dramatically increasing the resolution of microscopes so that we could actually see individual molecules inside a cell. The trick is that those three individually came to it, but one of them, Betzig, did not come to it on his own completely. In 2006, when he published his microscope, he had actually built it in a colleague's living room. When they published their new microscope and new technique in the journal Science, one of the top journals of science, one of them was the very first author, which is called the leading author. One was the very last author in the author list, and that's called the anchor author. And those two are really, it's hard to decide which one would be more important, but in their case, they actually put an asterisk on their author list and said these two people contributed equally.
And don't tell me one of them got it and one didn't.
Betzig got it. Harold Hess did not.
Can I tell you something? You know, I'm always listing, adding to my list of outrages. I didn't even know about this, and I'm outraged.
You know what,
here's a quiz for you.
Should ban the Nobel Prize.
Exactly. I'm going to get it. Do you know what city in America has more Nobel Prize winners, not just science, all Nobels, than any city in the United States of America? Live there.
Newton,
Massachusetts.
Newton.
That is exactly correct.
I did not know.
Hey, I'm so aggravated about that. I don't even want to talk about it anymore.
Let's
but
be aggravated
the good
about
thing
something
is,
else. This is so upsetting.
And this will get us to what the other thing we want to talk to you about is this World Wildlife Federation thing, which is unbelievable. 11 Nobel laureates. People always like me say, well, what do they do now? I mean, do they activists? Do they use their platform? 11 Nobel laureates got together in Paris to do exactly what I would hope they do, use their celebrity to do something good. What were they doing?
Well, so this is apparently the fourth time that there's been this small powwow of Nobel laureates to talk about the state of the planet and what directions we need to take to potentially improve on that. And so climate change definitely came up. Interestingly, they mentioned the LED lighting as one significant technological advance, but say that's not enough. And basically putting out a message with their clout, which goes to your point. Yeah. You know, what do these Nobel winners do with their money? I mean, split it three ways, $400,000 for most of these people. It's not like they're going out and buying luxury yachts. It's going toward maybe their research or maybe towards speaking engagements. And really what it's about is the clout that they gain, almost the celebrity status from being a Nobel laureate.
And they also use the money to buy the silence of the fourth person who didn't get the Nobel. We're talking to Heather Goldstein. Heather, I didn't know about this till yesterday, and I am mortified. The World Wildlife Federation, it's related to these 11 laureates getting together, said that over the last 40 years, 1970 to 2010, while the world population of humans has doubled, the population of vertebrate, of animals, mm-hmm. wildlife, has been cut 52%. Is that possible?
It's possible. You know, it's really difficult to put an exact number on in particular, whether you're talking about the number of individuals in a population of animals or just the total number of species that
we
have on our
planet. Well, even if it's 40%. I mean, it is stunning.
Right. Why? Huge. It says in here the worst decline was among freshwater species, which fell by 76%.
Yeah. I mean, there's very little good news when you talk about extinction and loss of what's called biodiversity, the diversity and variety of wildlife on the planet. And in fact, a UN report just came out recently. There's a group called the Convention on Biological Diversity that looks at this. And they actually recently met and said, we are doing a dismal job. In 2010, they set 20 goals for 2020. We're on track to maybe meet 5 of those, and have one analysis found we've made basically no progress on 10 of those with this international agreement in place and even with the action that's been taken. I mean, it's really tough. As population, part of the problem is, you say
the population
has
yeah.
doubled, development has increased. And there's been an interesting shift in how conservation even looks at this problem of species extinction and conservation from, I think, when conservation really got started, it was about the preservation of nature, setting aside big chunks yeah. as parks or preserves. And then it kind of turned into, we're trying to save species despite human development. So we'll say, well, you can't build a house here, build it over here to protect that owl that lives in that tree or that sort of thing, and trying to find ways to accommodate a little. And then it shifted again to, well, we need to look at this in terms of what nature does for us, the services it provides. Maybe that'll, help things. And it's kind of worked its way around to, okay, you can't really look at it one way or the other. We're part of this ecosystem. But that actually makes it that much more complicated to figure out where we have successes and where we have challenges, because measuring that relationship is a lot harder than even trying to measure an extinction, and that's hard enough.
We only have a minute left, but I would say this story, and I don't do what you do, I am stunned how under the radar this story has been. I mean, I can't tell you how many people, including Marjorie, I told about it yesterday.
I had no idea.
Had no idea. But in the minute we have left, assuming we continue to do the things that are, and it's hunting, by the way, they say, overfishing plus climate change, assuming that we don't cut back on those things because we haven't of late, where are we in 20 years? If this is what happened in 40 years, we have 80% of wildlife gone, 90%? I mean, what happens?
I mean, honestly, even bigger than the hunting and the direct kind of harvest of animals, what most experts say at this point is it's habitat loss. It's development. It's how much we're sprawling out and cutting into natural habitats. And it's going to take a major reworking to try to develop in a different way and feed and house, looking at 9 billion people by the middle of the century without completely wiping out nature, which, of course, has absolutely no good effect on us either.
Well, that's cheerful.
52%. I'm almost.
Let's go back to the Nobel.
I know.
I'm outraged about that. I'm outraged about the fourth person not getting the Nobel.
Well, you're always outraged, dude. Perpetual outrage. Okay. Heather Goldstone, I'm glad you're not outraged, because you're going to deal with this every single day. WGBH is science. Maybe you are outraged. She's an expert in ocean science. Heather, great to see you. Thank you so much for being here. Up next, we continue our candidate interview with Democratic congressional candidate Seth Moulton. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan. We're continuing our final round with the candidates before Election Day. Here with us in Studio 3 is Seth Moulton. Seth's a Democrat running to represent the 6th Congressional District. His Republican opponent, Richard Tesei, was here yesterday. Seth, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming as well. Since you are a veteran and we're in the middle of this mess overseas, you want to talk a little bit about the war, if we can call it the war, that we're engaged in over there. We had your opponent, upcoming Republican Richard Tesei, in here yesterday, and he was saying that if the president proposes ground troops, he'd go with the president. From what I've read about you, and you've been in Iraq 4 times, you're in a different place.
That's right.
Where are you?
I don't think we should use ground troops right now in Iraq, and I'll be happy to explain that. But I also think that it's not Congress's role to simply agree with the president. We have a checks and balances system of government, and Congress ought to ask the toughest questions and demand the highest standards before we put young men and women into harm's way overseas.
I will forget harm's way for a moment. Would you have supported the president's $500 million proposal to arm and train Syrian rebels?
No, I would not.
Why not?
Because I don't think we have a clear enough long-term strategy for making sure that those weapons don't fall into the wrong hands. Don't forget the president said a year and a half ago that we shouldn't arm the moderates in Syria for exactly this reason. And that risk has only worsened today because the moderates in Syria have become marginalized.
But everyone, not everyone, but lots of people back here in the United States are in a low-level panic over ISIS, and they're watching the terrible beheadings, and they're kind of marching right across Iraq and now close to the Turkish border. Should we be there at all?
We absolutely should defeat ISIS. ISIS has killed Americans abroad, and they've made clear their intentions to kill Americans here at home. So our policy should be to defeat ISIS. But in making that declaration, we get to reserve decisions on the timeline and the means to ourselves. And if you look at what happened when ISIS had this dramatic expansion from Syria into western and then northern Iraq, they didn't just defeat the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army put their weapons down and went home because they had lost faith in their government. And so fundamentally, the problem in Iraq today is a political problem. And unless we solve that political problem first, we'll be back solving the military problem for them again.
So let's assume we don't solve the political problem. Let's assume the new prime minister of Iraq is not as inclusionary as he says, unlike al-Maliki, his predecessor. You say we do have to defeat ISIS. Virtually every person, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, says airstrikes are not enough. What if the Iraqi military never steps up to the plate? What if the Syrian moderate, the alleged moderate Syrian rebels can't pull it together and the Kurd fighters aren't enough? What do we do then?
I'm not going to speculate about what might happen down the road, but I can tell you right now we've got to get the Iraqi military to do its job. And I've worked with these guys. They're not the best army in the world.
What'd you do with them?
I worked with them. I fought alongside them. I trained them. In fact, my mission 10 years ago last month in Iraq as a Marine platoon commander was a military advisory mission. I was on the ground as a military advisor in Iraq. And I can tell you that when the Iraqi unit that we were assigned to train and fight with came under attack from the militia and started to get overrun, we went to their aid, and that started the Battle of Najaf, the worst ground combat of the war until that point. So a military advisory mission can very quickly become ground combat, and we've got to be very careful of that happening in Iraq today. Let's not forget, the Vietnam War started as a military advisory mission.
So should we not have sent them?
I was just going to say, we do have military advisors over there right now, obviously.
So was that a mistake too?
That's right. Well, I think it's a mistake insofar as we should make sure we fix the political problem first. Now, the president was absolutely right to deal with the crisis of the Yazidis on the mountain to make sure that a genocide didn't occur. And he's right to beef up the protection of American personnel in Iraq. But we can't just start solving the Iraqis' military problem without conditioning it on political progress, because otherwise we'll be back solving the military problem again for them 2 years from now. I've worked with these guys. They're not the best military in the world, but they outnumber ISIS something like 30-1. They have tanks, artillery, aircraft. There's no reason why these guys shouldn't be able to take care of this problem. And at the end of the day, Iraq has got to be able to defend its own borders and protect its own people.
So when you say they're not the worst military in the world, is this because of the Sunni-Shia split and all the resentments against al-Maliki, the former prime minister? I mean, is that what's wrong with them? Is there something else wrong with them that makes them less than the best military operation around?
Actually, the Iraqi military was one of the most proud institutions in Iraq. It was often able to rise above the sectarian divisions that have come to define the political process in Iraq today. But at the end of the day, if you're going to put your life on the line for your country, you have to have faith in your government. And there's no question that Prime Minister Maliki's government became so sectarian that it started to lose the trust of its people. And I'll tell you, this should not have come as a surprise either, because when Ambassador Crocker and General Petraeus came back to Congress to report on the surge, they basically said two things. One, the surge has been remarkably successful on the military front. We've made much more progress than we expected. But on the political front, we've not seen as much progress as we need. And so they called for a diplomatic surge. We built the largest embassy in the world, the largest American embassy in the world in Baghdad, but then we left it half full. So we know that the Iraqis need political mentorship. We need to provide it.
I needed a bit of an explainer from you, Seth Moulton, who's the Democrat running in the 6th Congressional District to succeed John Tierney. CNN's headlines this morning were that ISIS controls one-third of Kobani, this town on the border there. What does control mean? I mean, in tangible ways, on the ground, what does it mean to control a third of a major city, even though the United States is poo-pooing it, saying it's not that big a deal, which obviously it is? What does that mean?
It's a great question, because I think that the way CNN is using that term in this article is to say that this military force occupies the city. But that does not mean they control the population. That does not mean they have the support of the population. In fact, when al-Qaeda took over western Iraq in the 2006-2007 timeframe, Initially, they were well-liked because they provided some stability and security. They even had a court system. But very quickly, it was clear to the Iraqi people that they were too extreme. One Iraqi told me that, Al-Qaeda wouldn't let them walk down the streets holding hands, and then they said they couldn't shave their beards, and it was all over when they said they couldn't smoke. So the point...
that was the final straw.
That was the final straw. But the point is that ISIS has swept across a huge portion of Iraq. That doesn't mean they actually have the allegiance of the people who live in those cities and towns.
We're talking with Seth Moulton, who's running for Congress in the 6th Congressional District. Richard Tisay, we had him in yesterday as his Republican opponent. You know, before we leave the war, you kind of two things, actually. We talk about this a lot, Jim and I, about how we wouldn't be so quick to be sending young men and women to war if there were a draft and everybody had, as it were, skin in
the
game.
No, we didn't say we wouldn't be that quick. We wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah, okay,
we
wouldn't be doing it. What do you think about a draft?
Well, I think that there are a lot of problems with the military that we had out of a draft. But I am a strong supporter of increased national service opportunities. Now, that doesn't mean that it's mandatory to do national service.
Why not? I think why shouldn't at least – I'm not saying military. Why shouldn't there be mandatory service for every high school graduate in America, Seth Moulton?
Well, right now, there's tremendous demand for more service opportunities. So we don't even need to have mandatory service just to try to meet the demand that's out there. Because right now, there are 5 AmeriCorps applicants for every available spot. And I've been working with General McChrystal on national service. In fact, General McChrystal endorsed my campaign, and a lot of people figured it was because we served together in Iraq. Actually, I didn't know him in Iraq. I'd never met him, but I met him back here in America working on national service. We would be a much stronger country if every American felt a civic obligation to serve in some way, not just in the military, but civilian service options as well, places like City Year. General McChrystal envisions a time when if you go into a job interview when you're 30 years old, one of the first questions is, now, where did you serve? I think we'd be a better country if
that
were the case.
But look at Colin Powell. He made a big deal about this, 10 years ago, a volunteer national service thing, and it didn't really get very far.
Well, the new Franklin project that General McChrystal and others are working on, I think, has a lot of potential.
You think so?
Tufts just announced that they are doing national service fellowships. So if you come in as a freshman, you can take a year off before you start to do some sort of national service. So the movement is picking up. And to your point, absolutely, we would be more careful about going to war. I don't think we would have ever gone to Iraq if members of Congress, if a large number of members of Congress had a son or daughter in the military. And I'm not saying that we would just be a pacifist country either. I think we probably would have gone to Afghanistan.
Congress might even be in session to discuss whether we should be doing what we're doing, which would be a nice change.
One more question.
One other thing. We've never had fewer veterans in Congress in our nation's history.
Yeah.
We don't have a single combat veteran representing us in the House or the Senate from Massachusetts. So when we have to address these tough questions about ISIS, about Iran, we ought to have more people there who have the experience, who have been on the ground in the Middle East, and also have the credibility to hold the administration to account.
You know, one other thing before we move into politics, things away from the military, you kind of have an unusual path. I mentioned before we went on the air that there was this great quote from your mother saying that when you decided you were going to be a Marine, she couldn't have, I'm paraphrasing, but the only thing that would have made her more unhappy about your career choice is if you pursued a life of crime, joined the mob or something like that. You also went to Harvard. You don't see a lot of people taking your path from Harvard. So why? And also, you mentioned election night. Peter Gomes is one of your mentors, who was the late great chaplain at Harvard University, and wrote beautifully about things spiritual. Why did you choose to be a Marine?
Well, a lot of it does come back to the mentors that I had in college, and especially Reverend Peter Gomes. I took his class. He was quite a professor, in addition to being the minister at Harvard, and a moral force on campus. And he talked a lot about the importance of service. How it's not enough just to believe in service or support those who serve. You ought to go find a way to serve yourself. So I looked at different options. I looked at the Peace Corps. I looked at teaching overseas. But at the end of the day, I had so much respect for the 18 and 19-year-old kids who put their lives on the line for our country that I decided that that's where I wanted to serve myself. Now, I had no idea that I'd be getting into a war. I graduated in June of 2001. So September 11th happened 3 months later, and my training started shortly after that, and before I knew it, I was on the front lines in the first company of Marines into Baghdad.
Okay, so I have the unenviable task, Seth Moulton, of moving from the spiritual to back to politics at home. You've taken criticism on a couple of fronts this week. One, you canceled a debate here tonight with on Emily Rooney's show, said you'd do a fundraiser with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC. And secondly, you've been criticized for raising a ton of your money leading up to the primary, not amongst your constituents, but out of state, Wall Street, et cetera, 60-some percent out of state. Guilty on both counts or no?
Look, we have six debates in this race in the short time between September 9th and the general election on November 4th. The presidential candidates are able to get by with three. I think six is enough. I felt bad that we couldn't make the schedule work, and I'd love to be on the show again. But you know, that's just the reality of having an incredibly tight schedule.
How about the out-of-state money?
Look, I've been humbled by the support that we've received from this race from around the country. The majority of our events are in the district. But I think that this story of a young, pragmatic veteran taking on a career politician, both in the primary and now again in the general, is resonating with people far and wide. And I've been surprised and also humbled by the number of folks who recognize this is an important race, not just here in Massachusetts, but beyond our borders.
Is that kind of split going to continue in your post-primary leading up to final when the reports come out for how much you raised post whatever the primary day was leading up to November 4th? Is it still going to be a majority of the money from out of state?
I'm not sure. We get literally hundreds of contributions.
But what do you think? But
I would imagine that the national interest is still there. I mean, there's certainly been a lot of national attention paid to this race in the press.
Speaking of national interest, the good news and the bad news, sort of the best times, worst times, I guess. Michael Bloomberg, a local kid, and then made $1 billion and moved out of town. A kid from Medford, obviously the former mayor of New York, Democrat, Republican, then independent, endorsed your candidacy the other day. But at least as of a day or two ago, the two people who ran against you, John Tierney, you ran against him, I guess. He was the incumbent. And Marisa DeFranco, who also ran the Democratic primary, have not endorsed you. Why? What does that say about the support for your candidacy amongst whomever back home?
Well, what I'm finding from voters in the district is that people are really rallying to my candidacy. And the day after the election, that morning at 7 a.m., I was down meeting voters at the train station in Salem on my way to Boston. And I met a lot of voters who supported me in the primary, but I also met a lot of voters who supported the congressman or Marisa or other candidates. And what I found is that they wanted to meet me and they wanted to know what I was all about, but they're very quickly rallying to the cause.
Why haven't they supported you, though? I mean, it's been a while. Was it a month or at least a couple of weeks since the primary? Why haven't it? Well, Tierney in particular, when the Democratic infrastructure, even though I'm told you were treated actually fairly shabbily at that unity breakfast, that you had to wait and wait and wait.
Would you wait an hour and a half or something like that, an hour and 45 minutes?
He won't say that. But in any case,
okay,
he's smiling, half smiling.
He was over there with the people that lost,
okay,
is the bottom line.
But Seth, why isn't Tierney, if the rest of the infrastructure, almost all of whom endorsed Tierney, have said Seth is now our guy, what's the Tierney issue?
I can't speak for the congressman.
Have you spoken to him?
I've reached out to him several times.
And he hasn't called you back?
We look forward to speaking.
He hasn't called – you have not spoken to Tierney since the election?
Not yet. But what I have found is that the Democratic establishment that admittedly was aligned against me in this primary has very quickly rallied to my side, not just in Massachusetts. Senator Tom McGee, the chairman of the state party, and others have been wonderful in working to really bring – not just reaching out to me individually, but working to bring Democrats together, but also at the national level in Washington, D.C. They've really rallied behind my campaign. So I've been thrilled with that support.
You know, one thing that is very attractive, I think, to some voters is that we don't have any Republicans in our delegation. It is a Democratic delegation all the way through. Almost everybody votes the same way all the time. How do you counter that? I mean, are you, you know, to say as a Republican, are you going to be, as he's accused, like just another kind of rubber stamp for all the Democratic agendas? And why should people believe you might be any different?
Absolutely not. If I did what all the Democrats wanted me to do, I would never have even entered this race. So from the very beginning, I've been willing to go against the establishment. I'm someone who proudly fought in a war that I disagreed with. So I have no concerns about my ability to take an independent stance on the issues. But the reality is that today in Washington, the Republican agenda in the majority is being controlled by the far right. And we can't add anything more to that majority. We can't strengthen that majority that's tried to shut down the government, that's fought against healthcare, that fights regularly against women's rights and gay rights. We can't strengthen
but
that majority.
You could argue that to say would be throwing strength to the other side because he's a moderate Republican and certainly you could say almost liberal on social issues.
No, he's not going to. He said his first vote is for John Boehner as Speaker of the House. So he's absolutely going to be party to that agenda. And the idea that a freshman Republican from Massachusetts who can stand up to the Tea Party extremists is just not true. I mean, John Boehner himself tried to prevent the Tea Party coalition from shutting down the government, and he wasn't able to do that.
Yeah, Seth, speaking of Michael Bloomberg, we're talking to Seth Moulton, who's the Democratic candidate in the 6th Congressional District. Michael Bloomberg, I read part of what he said, and part of what he said, correct me if I'm wrong, is because you can reach across the aisle, that sort of thing. And I think the average voter, I'd say 90% of them, and that's just my guess, want bipartisanship. They're sick of the dysfunction. Give me an issue or two, despite, as you said a second ago, excoriating some of the more conservative elements of the Republican Party in the House. They'll have the majority if you're elected. Give me an issue or two where you would reach across the aisle and be willing to embrace their worldview on something so that something happened as opposed to a gridlock, which is what we live with for years.
Well, it's a great question because you're absolutely right. This is what voters want. Voters want people who can work across the aisle, and that's the premise of Mayor Bloomberg's endorsement, is he endorsed 10 candidates across the country who have the ability to work across the aisle. And he could very well have chosen Richard Desai, but I'm proud that he chose me for that ability.
So what's the issue that you could reach across the aisle on that would be hard, not an easy one, a hard one?
Well, I think one very difficult issue is corporate tax reform. And most Democrats think that we ought to close corporate tax loopholes because right now the biggest corporations in America often pay the lowest tax rates, and that's not fair to small businesses. But at the same time, a lot of Republicans think that we should lower corporate tax rates. Well, I think most Americans agree that there's a healthy compromise in the middle where if we were effectively able to close those loopholes, we could lower the corporate tax rate and make America more competitive.
Did you ever vote for a Republican?
I never have, but you know, I always try to vote on the person.
Can I ask you one last thing from me, and then, or do you want to go? One last thing.
Okay, real quick, and then I have a real quick one too.
You mentioned a minute ago, and I've heard you say it before. You know, I fought in a war. You did four tours, if I remember, that I disagreed with. Late at night, some nights, you're over there, and you're saying to yourself, "I don't agree with this thing. I'm putting myself at risk every day." I hate to say briefly, but briefly, how do you deal with that contradiction, for lack of a better expression?
I think it's hard, but I never wanted someone else to be there in my place. And that doesn't make me a hero. That just makes me any U.S. veteran. That's what any veteran would tell you. And that's why I kept going back, so that I could serve with the guys who I knew were over there. But the other thing I found is that being there on the ground in Iraq, I had a tremendous influence on the way the war was fought. And I worked hard every single day to save as many lives as I could, American and Iraqi. And I think I had more influence on this difficult war that I disagreed with being there on the ground than I would have had back here in America.
This has got to be a really quick answer because we are almost out of time here, practically out of time. A lot of us are confused about whom to believe on this war. You hear all these generals on television, you hear everybody talking. You're a smart guy, obviously. Is there a thinker on this war that you think has more credibility than others that we might look to when we're seeking to form our own opinions of what we should be doing?
Well, I certainly think that General Petraeus and General McChrystal, who are two of my mentors, are incredibly thoughtful on the war. I had lunch with General Petraeus just a couple days ago and talked a lot about ISIS and what to do. And he is a very, I think, wise man who has a tremendous amount of on-the-ground experience. But I tell you, when I want to know what's going on, yeah, I talk to them. I also talk to my Iraqi friends. I talk to friends in the Middle East to understand what's going on the ground. And I think that having that breadth of experience will be important in Congress.
What's your website, Seth?
SethMoulton.com.
Great to see you.
Thank you very much for coming in, Seth. Seth Moulton is a Democratic congressional candidate. He is running to represent the 6th District. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow at 11 o'clock. We've got a bunch of stuff. Charlie Baker, who's running for governor, is going to be with us in studio. Emily Rooney's world-famous list and, of course, our soon-to-be world-famous news quiz. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our team, Chelsea Merz, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer, John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm still upset about that fourth scientist who doesn't get the Nobel Prize. I can't get over that. I am Jim Browdy.
Yeah, you are Jim Browdy. I'm upset about the 52% of the animals that are
disappearing.
You should
be. We'll see you tomorrow.
Okay. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow, I hope.